Hey kids, this episode of the SML podcast has been brought to you by Neat Microphones, makers of the King Bee microphone, which is being used by guests of this podcast. Brought to you by Neat Microphones, makers of the King Bee microphone, which is being used by guests of this podcast. Brought to you by who the fuck?
What's up, everybody? This is the SML podcast. My name is Joe. I am your host. We've got a party cast going on later on in the episode, but for now, we have a fun little round table going down. A Neat Microphones round table. Joining this episode, we've got Chris Taylor. How are you doing, sir?
According to all known laws of aviation, there is no way that a bee should be able to fly. Its wings are too small to get its fat little body off the ground. The bee, of course, flies anyway because bees don't care what humans think is impossible.
Also joining the voice of the show.
You were great until you fucked that up at the end.
Yeah, I know.
The voice of the show, George Norgnavik. How are you doing, sir?
Great!
Grant Henry is also here. Stemmage, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I'm just glad I have a mute button handy. Otherwise, I would have snorblessed into my microphone. I had a great velocity.
Could you describe what that actually means? So I'm not familiar with the term snorblist.
I might. I'm going to do it real quick, but I'm going to mute before I do it.
Sweet. There you go. Oh, yeah. Do you need like a breath mint after that or something?
Sure, probably.
Here, I'll bring one over right away.
Thanks. And then we've also got Mr. Eric Peabody, Viking guitar, joining. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good, Joe. I'm not even going to try after all those other amazing intros. I'm good.
But you're all here to chat about the Neat King B2 microphone. We covered this on the show a couple of episodes ago with our friend David Ottavino, and Tim Ekibis was on chatting as well. For some reason, the PR guy likes us, and we got a couple more microphones, and we got them in the hands of some actual audio professionals who know what they're doing, and that's why you guys are here.
And me!
So tell us, what are your thoughts on this microphone, right off the bat, what are your thoughts?
Well, it's really neat!
You're listening to it right now, there. There, Joe, what do you think? How neat do we sound?
You pretty all neat, sound right? Fantastic, by the way.
Okay, let me ask everybody at the round table this. How many of you are going in raw, don't laugh, and how many of you are going in a processed fashion before getting into Joe's show?
You know, George, as you were about to start saying, I was thinking, we're all using the same mic. George just sounds really different. I'm like, I wonder what he's running through on the way in. So... good. We were on the same page. I'm just going straight into my interface, and it's a pretty low-level interface I'm using right now. It's an old Line 6 tone port, so it's just straight from the Neat into Mic 2 input, and I've got the gain up a little bit, and that's it. That's what you're hearing.
Mine is going through just a regular DI. Art Accessories USB Dual Pro is the cheapest thing I could find at the guitar store back when I was like, I need a DI of some kind. So, and yeah, no processing at all.
Grant, what about you? Raw baby! Steinberg, little two-channel thing with no processing before it's getting to your ears. Eric, I would be interested to hear this with your chain at some point, though. I know you have a thing you use for your VO work, and I would love to hear what that sounds like.
Yeah. If it was a two-channel preamp I used through the main interface and everything, I would have run this through it also, but I figured... for diagnostic purposes, it would be best to, you know, kind of keep it clean.
Yeah, yeah. What about you, Norgie?
I like to keep it filthy, and I'm running through all metal kinds zone. Of shit. The metal zone. Yes, that's the only way to go. So I'm actually running through a Warm Audio TB12 preamp. And then from there into a Tascam DM4800 digital mixer, which is then going into Cubase and being processed through an entire battery of things. Like there's a high pass filter and then an expander and then a compressor and then another EQ and then a limiter and then just a teensy weensy bit of distortion, which I'm going to disable because I don't want to do that anymore. And then finally a limiter at the very tail end. That's my podcast guest chain.
George, now, you're just running it through one instance of sausage fattener and you know it.
Dude, it's not a party until the sausage comes out. I was wearing that shirt the day I met you. Remember that?
I do remember that, actually, now that you mention it. And yet here we are, still friends.
So now, let's compare a little bit. I'm going to switch over to a clean stack. And then this is what you've got of me now. This is just a... There's no processing happening at this time. It is mic into preamp into interface, and that's it. It probably sounds significantly different.
Yeah.
It's quieter, but it still sounds really clear and really good.
I'm trying to ride the game to compensate a little bit.
Sounds like it's a baseline, right? I mean, it sounds like this, but it sounds great. You know, it sounds like probably what we sound like.
Yeah. It actually, to my ears, this sounds a bit clearer just because, you know, I know for podcast stuff and everything, a lot of that processing is, you know, advantageous, but it also can, you know, it sounds a little crunchy because the distortion and the even volume gets a little fatiguing and all that stuff. I like the sound of your voice as it is, George, and it's nice to hear
best. Oh my gosh. So I want to throw a question out to everybody because I know in the context of voiceover, I've compared this to a few different microphones, and I've got some opinions about it, but I want to hold back on that until I've had a chance to hear from everybody else, because I'm guessing, Eric, you've probably used it in the voiceover context, and have you tried it with any actual instruments?
No. In fact, I was, before everyone else got on here, I was regaling them with my equipment acquisition woes and realizing that I didn't have another XLR cable and I didn't have another mic stand and a few things like that. So I only got everything today, plugged it in, set it up right next to my primary mic, which is a Neumann TLM-102, and just set them at approximately the same position and did a couple quick paragraphs of VO. And then listen back. They definitely have a different characteristic, but it's pretty damn close. And, you know, that's a very specific use case. You know, I wasn't screaming. I wasn't, you know, way back at the far end of the room where echoes will be worse. I wasn't trying instruments. But just for those two, it sounded pretty comparable, like to the point where, you know, taking into account the cost difference, I think this runs for what, about 170?
Yep, $169.99.
I was close, you know, compared to the, you know, the Neumann, which is definitely more expensive, you know, presented with
something
two
like that
options,
run
about $750, I think. Wow. New. So, yeah, I mean, the Neumann is the better mic. I'm happy to have it. But knowing this thing is capable of what it is at a significantly lower price point, it's a damn good option. You know, if I didn't have the Neumann and I was just looking to get a mic to either get started or to upgrade from whatever USB mic I had or something, this would be a killer choice.
Yeah, I recorded a little bit of my cheap classical guitar on it, and I found it to be very nice, although it was a little hard to kind of get the positioning quite right. But that's also because I'm a very amateur recordingist.
That is a good point. It's a very heavy microphone and, you know, something where you might be on an arm or, you know, having to position it for an acoustic guitar, that I could see that being challenging.
Yeah, but like even, you know, when I turned it up a little or, you know, kind of backed it off a little bit and still played the guitar into it, like it was pretty darn good. And, you know, of course, it's not this particular guitar is like, I have it right here in front of me. It's very, you hear a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
If you start playing it, because it's all like satiny and like a very thin satiny finish, so you know anything that you're playing, you're going to hear some of that in the background. So, but I just wanted to try it with something acoustic that's not packed away, since I'm in the middle of moving right now.
And yeah, I tried acoustic as well.
Cool.
Did you compare it to any other mics you had around? Like, did you know just for
well the
comparison?
Here's the thing. The microphone I've been using for everything has been an SE Electronics supercardioid microphone. So not the best for instruments because it's so directional and it's like meant for, you know, vocals where you're just right up on it. And that's the way I usually do. Like, I bought it as a vocal mic for my very rare singing engagements where I use a pretty big voice when I sing, so I definitely wanted it. And I get very close to the microphone too, so super cardioid is great for that. But for like podcasting purposes, you know, it's just not I mean, it's fine, but like, yeah, for like recording guitar, it just doesn't have that big range that picks up everything, you know.
Yep. What are your guys' opinion of the pop filter that comes built into this thing?
Well, I like it just because my other microphone also has a built-in pop filter. It's not as thick.
Yeah, my the large diaphragm mic that I use normally is a Shure KSM-27, which is the older model of the SM-27, which is still around. It could not have less of a pop filter. Right, so it's kind of like it was fun putting them side by side and being like pumpernickel, and just kind of seeing what the hell happened. I decided to put a pop screen on this is the neat right now, and so like I'm just gonna pumpernickel at you guys. This is with a pop screen over it. Pumpernickel, pump, and then pumpernickel, pump, pump. Do you hear a difference?
Yeah,
pumpernickel.
You took it off
a little
there.
Bit. I took it off here. Pumpernickel, airplane. But I will say I compared it to the KSM and it was like, I mean, it was insane. I'm again right up on this thing. I'm like, you know, 2.5 inches away. It is a very functional pop screen for the kind that it is. It's not pantyhose floating in space like, you know, you would normally use in addition to a microphone. But I thought it was pretty functional. I did not go in and see if it made a difference in the sound at all. Just the character of the sound. Did you play with that at all, Norg?
I did, actually. I didn't notice a lot of change. I am using a separate pop filter in front of this thing. What my estimation of the pop filter that comes with it is, it's good enough to save you from yourself if you just completely forget to consider mic technique as a voiceoverister. It will disperse some of a plosive and probably protect the diaphragm better than if you just left the thing naked. Having said that, if you're doing something crazy like singing or yelling or anything that is going to involve a lot of potential for plosives or wind or F sounds, I would highly recommend adding another pop screen in front of it. It will work fine as long as you're keeping your distance and the mic is a little bit above the bridge of your nose and aimed down. If at any point you ever need to consider proximity effect, I would say you probably need an extra pop filter in front of the thing just because it's thin, it's a utility that does work, and I'm really impressed that they included it with everything that has already been included with this thing for the
like
price
shock
point.
Mount.
Like, holy crap, yeah. This shock mount. Wow.
That was a very pleasant surprise, yeah.
And it's a good thing, too, because I'm not sure I have any other shock mounts that would be able to handle this thing. It's
yeah, I think that's why they. It's interesting. I actually did some testing with the shock mount as well, so it's very sturdy. But I did notice. Okay, so my KSM shock mount's a pretty generic. It's very thin metal and rubber bands. You know, it's minimal hardware. This thing is kind of like it's been engineered. It's pretty hardcore, and I almost wonder. I did some playing with it, and I found that the only negative on the shock mount, and then it's a big plus, which I love. The big negative is that it has its own like resonant frequency. I did some tapping on the shock mount compared to my KSM shock mount, and this thing sings. Like, this thing has a little
really? Okay.
going on that I noticed. So if you got a little bumpy with it, you might notice it. But I think it's just because there's a lot more metal going on. This thing's a lot more over engineered than a lot of shock mounts. But again, this mic is beef. Like, I think it needs it. You know,
is the size a turnoff with a microphone like this? It's such a beefy, heavy, large microphone. I was saying this when David was on doing his official review of it, that I tried, or I wanted to hook it up to my microphone, and my mic arm just fell immediately. It couldn't hold it at all. Like, my mic arm is too weak to deal with the beef that is the King Bee.
This thing is very chunk. There's no question about it. I would argue that if you are getting a microphone of this specific level of quality and caliber for the price point that you have, you can probably afford the opportunity to get a slightly beefier microphone stand, and it's worth it.
Yep.
I think anybody who is into music or recording or voiceover restoring or anything where a microphone is going to be concerned, you want to have a good, solid, capable microphone stand. Now, having said all that, I cheat outrageously. I have all of my microphone hardware mounted to a bunch of half-inch pipe that is drilled into the ceiling of my booth. And everything is held to, everything is hanging from that using DW drum hardware. So it's set for just about anything that you can throw at it in terms of heft and weight and girth. And the other thing, and this is going to be a minor shout out for Hook Studios. They make three products that I am addicted to and cannot function without. Two of them are microphone decouplers. And I'm mentioning this because Grant talked about the resonant frequency of the shock mount. If these decouplers are capable of being added to a mic stand for very little weight, and they will literally decouple the shock mount from any stand that you are using. So I could hit the half inch pipe that's holding this entire thing together, and the shock mount wouldn't hear anything. I have two of them, one for heavier mics, one for less beefy mics. And then there was another point I was going to go into and I forgot it. I'll come back to it later if I can remember it. This thing is hefty. It's worth having a good mic stand anyway if this is something you're going to take seriously. So I would just say harden the F up and get yourself a good mic stand. You will be really happy you have one.
Similar to Joe, like I have, you know, a boom mic stand thing that, I couldn't put this in there. It would just fall right over unless I, like, you know, placed it just right. So I went out and bought a Onstage brand, just like an old school microphone stand with like the kind of concrete bass, like very heavy bass. And it goes straight up about 8 inches. And
wow,
and it can expand a little further. And it's holding it down pretty well. I mean, if my cat bumped it from the back, though, it would probably, you know, come forward. But, you know, he ain't here, so.
Yeah, I have the exact same one.
And put a dent in the hardwood.
Yeah. It would do that. Yes. Either this mic or this stand. I have the exact same Onstage, like, nice table stand, which I'm using right now. And then I did hook it up to a boom mic, or a boom stand, it's not a particularly nice stand, but I needed to do that because I didn't have a second one of these, and I wanted to compare with my Shure mic. You can make it work. You can also experiment with this thing upside down. I will also say it's a very tall microphone. It's taller than my KSM by a large amount. I had to like lower my desk for it. So it's a very peculiar design. I don't know mics that well. So maybe there are other ones that look just like this, but it's kind of awesome. It looks way more premium and feels more premium than the price would lead you to believe.
Agreed. I also sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but like going back to pop filters for just a second, the pop filter that's in front of it has this kind of honeycomb look to it. I think that's a pretty cool touch.
Yep.
Yeah.
That was a really nice engineering touch.
Yeah. The whole thing feels very sleek, but not, not like it's showing off. It just looks very, I don't know, it's just a nice looking piece of audio gear to have around.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't stand out as being some weird something strange. It's just other thing about the shock mount, it does have a ratcheting the pivot point on the The pivot point on the shock mount is ratcheting, which I love. And it kind of needs to be that way, given how heavy this thing is. I don't think the ratchets are very close. I felt like it was sort of straight up and then back of probably a few more degrees than I wanted. But for something this heavy, I think having the ratchets is nice. Because my
every mic stand should have ratchets.
Yeah, like, I know.
My
KSM shock mount doesn't have it, and I still have to keep a quarter handy to put on the other side of the knob to into the flathead, you know, screw side to kind of tighten it up a little. And the KSM's not even that much. That's not even that big of a deal. It's just that's just how that stuff works. So they were thinking. They know this mic's heavy, but they didn't include a stand. Just the shock mount.
for the price point, I mean, come on.
Yeah, I didn't mind buying a stand for it. Like I said, it was $18 for me, so
yeah.
I did buy the floor model, so that might have knocked a couple of dollars off.
Yeah, I, you know, coming from the standpoint of, you know, back in the day, just scrimping together any money I could to get the thing I was saving for, it would be a little disappointing if I had finally, you know, in high school or whatever, saved up my $170 and bought this and it showed up. And if I realized that the mic stand I had currently was just grossly insufficient to hold this thing, that would have been a little disappointing. But I think that, you know, as long as you can see what the weight is, I was surprised by how heavy it was. I don't know if I'd trust, you know, any of the default mic stands you have in, you know, practice rooms and stuff that are only used to holding a 57 or a 58 or something.
Yeah.
Not even close.
No, it's hefty. It's a home defense microphone, you know.
Keep it by my bedside.
Exactly. You
know? A load bearing microphone.
Yes.
On this thing. This might actually, this is revealing how much of a noob I am with microphones that I didn't know this. So I actually thought that my mic stand wouldn't work on it because I didn't realize that the little adapter that's up in the threading actually comes out. So I took the whole thing with me to the music store to like try that out. And they were like, oh yeah, this comes out. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm dumb. So if you are a noob, know that the little, you know, when you open it up and you look in the little threading that's supposed to go into the stand, you know, screwed into the stand, that is an adapter for a different kind of threading. So you can just take that out with, like, you know, a quarter or a pair of scissors or something.
Yep, yeah, that's important. For
sure. I still don't know why they do that. It drives me bonkers, but here we are.
Gentlemen, this has been great. I'm sorry I have to duck out, but just in summary, I'm really stoked with this thing. I absolutely would buy one if I didn't have one already. So, Joe, thanks for setting this up, and I'll talk to you all later, okay?
Eric, thank you so much for being here, hanging out with us.
Thanks,
do you
Eric.
Have any final
peace
words
out, brother.
Before,
good to talk to you.
Before you head out?
Well, you know, you always have to keep the world metal, but outside of that, I'm good. You guys have a good one, okay?
Take care.
Take care, buddy.
Good night. Bye.
So let's wax a little bit nerdy here.
Okay.
I spent a little bit of time. I wanted to really dive into this with a variety of different instruments, and unfortunately, I only had enough time to pull out an acoustic guitar and a ukulele, and you're not going to get much of a difference between acoustic guitar and ukulele. I ran a couple of lines through four different microphones using VoiceOver and with this guitar and a ukulele. The four microphones were this one, the King B, and then the VoiceOver community's dream microphone, the Stellar X2, which I had to get one to find out if the hype was everything they said it was, and the jury's still out. And then the mic that I'm probably using the most right now for virtually everything, which is the Rode NTG5 shotgun mic. And then finally, because it was my first big major microphone purchase several years ago, and is the workhorse for everything that I don't need a shotgun mic for, which is like a lot, is a Lauten Audio Atlantis. There are some significant price differences in between those four microphones. The King B is the least expensive of the four. You can get a Lauten Audio, well, we'll go to the X2. The X2, again, this thing swept through the realm of voiceovers like wildfire. And
is it a large diaphragm microphone? Is it a shotgun mic?
It is a large diaphragm microphone.
Okay.
And
not familiar with that.
It is. It
real,
runs for
real
about,
quick before you continue, George. I got to give a quick shout out to Vertically Impaired who just dropped a sub. George, do you wanna yell anything at him for subbing to us?
Dropping fucking subs, motherfucker!
Neatest subs ever. Neat
Love
subs.
It. Anyway, Neat you were Neatly. You were saying.
So, Stellar X2 clocks in at $199.99, $200. Sometimes, depending on where you're shopping, you might be able to find them for $169.99, which sounds like a comparable price point. You can find them used for about $120. The NTG5 retails for $500, and that's the shotgun mic. And then the behemoth, the Atlantis, which is a three-pattern monster, goes in for $1,500. Now, out of the four microphones, I would say the Atlantis is probably the most versatile, most capable of anything in my arsenal. It's like cheating at recording. The end. There's no question about that. Having said that, doing these recordings, we'll stick with acoustic guitar for a second. The Atlantis was definitely the best representative. The Rode NTG5 is not a good vehicle in my mind for an acoustic guitar because it's a shotgun, and that's not the kind of sound I'm looking for. It sounded fine, it just wasn't the sound I'm looking for. So then you've got the comparable price point large diaphragm microphones, the Stellar X2 and the King Bee. And I felt that the King Bee was a little bit crispy in the top end when I was recording acoustic guitar, but if I thought the King Bee was crispy in the top end, the X2 pretty much just took the cake on that. It's like when you want the crunchy taco, or you want the crunchy taco with the chalupa outward because you want like the best of both worlds. This was just, it was all crunchy taco, and I was not enjoying it at all. So a lot of that probably had to do with proximity. The mics are not going to be that close to the acoustic guitar when I'm recording it because I'm not a good acoustic guitarister, and I'd probably bump the mic. So it ranked in terms of which I would use, I would start with the Atlantis. I would immediately go to the King Bee. And then I would probably go to the NTG5, and that Stellar X2 was last place. Switching over to voiceover, which, again, the X2 was the voiceover world's dream baby for the longest time. Again, we've got four completely different microphones. I'm going to leave the NTG5 out of this because it's the only shotgun mic, and it serves a completely different purpose. It kind of approximates what the other standard, quote-unquote, voiceover microphone would be, and that's the Sennheiser 416. The only reason I have an NTG5 is because my 416 kicked the bucket. It needs a capsule replacement, and I need to get it over to Sennheiser, but that's another story for another time. For voiceover between the three large diaphragm microphones, again, the Atlantis completely takes the cake. It's cheating at recording. But when you've got two microphones down in the lower end with two very similar price points between the X2 and the King Bee, there was very little doubt in my mind that the King Bee was the superior of the two microphones. And based on retail price, it's better bang for the buck. Is it as good as the Lauten Audio Atlantis? No. Is it? But is the Atlantis like $1,350 better than the King Bee? I don't know. And we're not even going to talk about the U87. Let's just forget about the U87. I'm not even going to get a U87 because I record in a small booth, and U87s don't sound good in a small booth. You know what does sound good in a small booth? The King frickin' Bee. Like,
boom.
And I'll tell you what, I cheat a little bit further with the Atlantis by switching it into figure eight mode because it just, the slight shift in the pickup pattern serves my voice very well. Having said that, I am really surprised at how well anything I've recorded with the King Bee has turned out. It's pound for pound, probably the microphone I would recommend to anybody who is new into voice recording and serious. And the reason I say serious is because there are a lot of people who want to start in voicing by getting a USB microphone and stepping into the walk-in closet and calling it a day, or getting under a blanket booth.
I feel attacked.
Good old Yeti.
The good old Yeti. Now, to be fair, I know people who have booked on the Yeti, and good for them. That's like two people.
Yeah, I got one over here. So, I mean, I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that is the strategy sometimes.
Oh, I'm totally. I'm not disagreeing. It gets the job done. It's just you run into trouble because of its noise floor. And when you're trying to, if you're very serious about this and you're trying to do something like book a national commercial, you can't do that on a Yeti. The noise floor for the King Bee is surprisingly good for the price point. I can't. I don't know how they managed to pack everything into this microphone that they packed into this microphone and put it on a shelf for $169.
Along with 10 pounds of concrete.
Right. Exactly. It's dense as all hell. And in fact, I'm going to go silent for just a second to give you a immediate read of after I turn my doggone it. I don't know if you can hear that sound, but that's the sound of a jet engine fan that sucks air out of my vocal booth. It's fantastic.
Nice.
The space intentionally left blank.
My noise floor was, for that silent moment, floating around like negative 61, 62 dB. That is completely acceptable. It is where you need to be if you are planning on taking this seriously. So my hat's off to Neat Microphones. They have accomplished a miracle at a price point in kind of a surprisingly heavy but small package.
Yeah, I feel like I my KSM, my Shure KSM, which was the only large diaphragm mic I have, I use it so regularly, and I've had it for a very long time. I've probably had it for about 12, 15 years, and I put these two together and started recording stuff and listening to each one and starting to really compare them. And then I forgot to check the price of the current version of this mic, this 27, like the SM27. And it's right now, I think it's on sale for $350, but it's normally $450. And that is such a huge jump from the cost of this microphone. And I had to kind of forget for a second that I was comparing details. I was just comparing character between these two microphones. There wasn't one that was truly more responsive than the other one, or one that I thought sounded objectively better with all the different tests I put them through. It was just like they were different, because all mics are different, right? Like this, the King Bee seems to be a little hotter in voice territory. What did you? There's something you said when you were talking about high end, Norg. What did you call it? It was a little.
Crispy.
Yes, it was a little crispy. And the KSM has a little more of the sheen, a little more of the high end. This has a little more of the lows you might get out of a voice. The KSM has a little more sub going on with a set with separate switches for that kind of thing, which, you know, obviously this mic doesn't have, because why would they bother? Because they're keeping the price down and it's not needed. But man, I kind of can't believe it, right? Like, it's not, I don't know what I would be using for different, I'm still unsure about which mic I might use in the future. I do know that when I hooked both of them up to my acoustic and we're sort of recording it live with both of them at my, in front of me, and I recorded with both of them and then just panned them out to each side for fun, it sounded like glory. It sounded amazing for what it's worth. Yeah, it was pretty awesome. So, I really feel like King Bee is hitting this, they're hitting this really good balance between value and quality that I don't think I don't review microphones for a living, but I don't think I've seen.
Well, you
this
do
happen.
Now.
Well, I do now.
This is your
really,
job now.
It's just the right, like, it's not expensive, but it's so good. You are going to have to get into, some sort of phantom power source, right? You're not going to be able to just plug this into your lappy. You're going to have something else. So there is a little bit of an investment there. But I'm also seeing the King Bee 2 on sale. So like right now, I think people are doing all kinds of sales. Maybe it's a seasonal thing, but, so I don't know. I'm very impressed. I got to the point where I was starting to look at like EQ profiles, but then I just sort of stopped, because why would I? I'm not going for two $500 microphones. You know what I mean? Like they're, yeah. And so I don't know. It's really interesting to hear your results, Norg, because I mean, and you had way bigger collection to test against mine, but it was kind of amazing to hear this thing pull punches.
Because I have a problem, and I can't stop collecting gear.
That's what you do. Dude, I buy VSTs and you got all your voice stuff.
Oh, man. Dude,
I'm not the voice boy. You're the voice boy.
You and I got to talk about VSTs at some point.
Oh, well, we will.
Like I have the entire Plugin Alliance collection.
Oh, very nice. Wow.
All of it. Because I started like when they only had 4 plugins.
Hell yeah.
And what are they at now?
A lot more.
Oh, a lot more
especially
than 4.
Now, yeah. Especially now that the parent company owns them and Isotope and Native Instruments.
Wow.
So Plugin Alliance and Brainworks now have access to all those libraries of things, and it's extensive, and I'm very impressed with that acquisition. It probably won't serve mixing engineers very well in the long term in terms of price points for things, but as far as being a conglomerate where you can literally get anything you could conceivably need from under one roof, that's smart marketing.
Yeah. Well,
but that was a tangent that we didn't need to go on.
No, anyway. anyway, the Neat King B2 Cardioid Solid State XLR Condenser Microphone is available at neatmic.com for $169.99. What are your thoughts on it? Is this something that people should invest in? Is this worth picking up for new recorders? Is it something that veterans can enjoy? Give us all your thoughts.
I would say that this is a microphone that any beginner could feel excessively comfortable in having, comfortable and confident. It comes with the caveat that there are 2 pieces of gear that you need in order to function it. One, we already talked about, and that is a good microphone stand. The other thing is you need an audio interface. This will not plug directly into anything. You need phantom power. Most decently priced audio interfaces are going to be able to supply the phantom power that this microphone needs, and you're good to go. And you don't have to get very expensive. You can get like a single channel Steinberg. You can get a Scarlett 2i2. Even I know a lot of people are saying don't get the Scarlett 2i2s now because the new manufacturing run is unreliable. But then you've got the
I don't want to get us on too much of a tangent, but man, people do go back and forth on those Scarlets.
They do, and it depends on the manufacturer.
It works fine for me, so.
Yeah.
The older generation Scarlets have lasted people for years and years and years, and it seems like the consensus is the newer ones tend to break down easier because of a manufacturing change.
Yeah.
But then you've got the Audient ID4, which is a nice, small, 2-channel interface for a comparable price. You can find used Steinberg interfaces like the CI2 will work perfectly fine, and you won't have to spend a lot of money on it, so. For beginners, at that point, I hope you're already consulting with somebody who's been doing this for a while. And if by some freakish chance you're a beginner and you're listening to this and you have no idea where to go, you email me and I will set you right. I promise you, I will not let you bungle this up the way a Guitar Center sales rep will.
Well, I was going to say, like, walking into not a Guitar Center, of course, no, God forbid, but a regular, you know, the local place, and walking in and being like, I need a USB out DI, preferably with 2 inputs, and they handed me this Artcessories thing, and they were like, yeah, that's $99. I was like, aight. And I've had this thing now for going on 10 years now, and it's been great. And so, yeah, a good DI is going to be, you know, if you're doing any kind of mic work, instrument work, recording, any kind of that stuff, you know, even streaming, that an investment in a DI is a must. So you're going to get that anyway. So you should, you know, and any microphone that's comparable to this one or above is going to need a DI as well. So needing a DI is not exclusive to this microphone. It's just, this is just good. This is just good gear sense at this point. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right, I would say I'll just say if you have if you can afford it and you want your if you want your voice to sound quite similarly to some of the people that you listen to that might own mics better than this one, this will get you there. You might need a few extras to get all the way, but it's the best inexpensive mic I've ever used for sure. So.
Yeah, and I'll add on to that one minor thing, and I know you experienced it and you outlined it even better than I could, Grant, and that is that if you're a recordist who is doing something in addition to or outside of the realm of voicing, I think this is a microphone that definitely needs to be in the locker just for the sake of the fact that the price point is fantastic for what you are getting. And it may not necessarily be your go-to main microphone if you're super fancy and you're using tube mics. And I'm not talking about recording studios because they're the ones that are using $50,000 microphones. Yeah. And good Lord, I'm talking about either smaller studios or project studios or home studios. This to me is a must-have. Home recorderisters. this is a must-have microphone.
Cool.
As an absolute beginner, I'm just gonna say I agree, and I would have loved to get this one as like my first sub $200, but you know, over $50, you know, home microphone, and I think I shall be using this in my streams from now on.
Nice. It's a nice step up from those pen microphones that we used in the 90s.
Oh God. Yeah,
my first voiceover gig on one of those. It was a telephony system in the back room of a telecom company.
Amazing. How did we ever survive?
How great were the computers wireless that had the built-in holders on them that you could just like slide the microphone on it and it just sat there? Oh, it was magic.
Oh, they were great.
Good shit. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We will be back with more show. I guess we'll play some from one of you guys, unless Chris, do you want to play a song for us?
Do I?
Yeah.
On what?
On your guitar.
Oh my Discord's goodness.
Discord's not going to let it happen.
Nah, Discord lovely. Doesn't like it.
No.
Does anyone have any final words to wrap this up?
You guys are
so good at this.
I'm just I'm like, Eric's not here to pull a pun, and I'm trying, but we've already been through them all. So,
oh man, well, it was great having the three of you on, and as well as Eric before chatting about this microphone. Big shout out to Step 3 PR who hooked us up with the microphone so that we could talk about them on this show and waste about a good hour and a half, hour 45 now between the two reviews, just talking about microphones. Yeah. Good shit. So,
check it.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thanks to you guys for being here. And music, here we go.
Music.
The cheat is grounded.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. Another huge thanks to our neat microphone roundtable party crew, whatever it was. Chris, you were there, weren't you?
I was. I still got the microphone. They didn't take it away from me.
Yay.
Yay.
Yay. But big thanks to everyone who was there chatting with us. We got reviews to take care of. Chris, you're still here. Aki's here. Brooke is here. How's everyone doing?
I'm good. Doing great.
So tired.
Everyone finally tired? Was it a long weekend for everyone?
Yeah, my weekend from work was a 4-day weekend, but it was 4 days of solid ass working on moving an apartment to a house. Yeah,
that's right. How did that go?
At least it's a house. It's something you own.
Yes. No, 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 no. Don't own it. No, no, no. We're renting.
He's like,
it's Austin.
I was about to say, bringing it back to Austin there.
Yeah, I mean, maybe some people know this outside of Texas. I don't know. But, like, the housing situation in Austin is so bad that you cannot buy a house with cash with more money than is asked for. You will get bought out. Like, it is nuts trying to purchase stuff around here. So a lot of people are purchasing more than one house and then renting them out to losers like me who want to pay the amount that you would, more than the amount that you would have paid to purchase a house, like about 5 or 6 years ago, to just rent it and never get the driveway fixed.
Yeah,
I'm so sorry. That sucks.
That's my situation. Yeah, it's fine. I chose to live among the cool people, so... who now live 40 miles away from me, because that's how far out in the proverbial sticks that I am. But at least I have a car.
Yeah, I can't even process, like, the scope of the area down there because of how big the cities in Texas are compared to, like, the few hundred-person towns I live around.
And, you know, getting bigger, like, in an irresponsible way. Because we don't have, like, we don't have a reliable power grid because it's owned by, like, rich people. It's not public. So it's not regulated by the government who have a responsibility to people's safety that private owners do not.
Realistically, Texas in general is just bad for that everywhere, isn't it?
Yep.
So all I keep hearing is about how the grid shuts down in winter because you can't handle... the cold, and then it shuts down in summer because it apparently can't handle the heat either. And it's like, what the fuck can you handle then, lukewarm? What the fuck? The one thing Texas isn't?
Yeah, lukewarm the 2 months of the year. It fortunately has not completely shut down in a summer yet, as far as I know. But yeah, we did have a big bad moment for winter that, you know.
A big bad moment for right around how many months was that?
I don't know. All of them? No.
That was like 2 or 3 months straight, wasn't it?
And it completely coincided with Ted Cruz's planned vacation to Mexico.
Oh, weird. Yeah.
He's such a useless cunt.
I know. It's terrible.
I can't even
the Zodiac Killer. So.
I know. My friend owns a coffee shop here in town, and they literally had that displayed prominently in the coffee shop. And Ted Cruz lives here, or like kind of he comes here a lot. So not that he would ever set foot in.
I love that this is something that like bridges the political boundaries. It's like it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. You hate Ted Cruz.
Yeah. You've heard the one about him being the Zodiac Killer.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. He is that, except, you know, he's killed way more people now.
Oh, yes. My God. It's accurate.
Quite a bit.
He has a lot of blood on his hands. He sure does.
Yeah.
Good for him, right? Good for him.
Yep. Got enough blood on his hands to keep warm all winter.
Yeah.
Anyway, how is everyone else doing?
Pretty good,
I went on a weird tangent.
I'm really thankful I don't live in Texas anymore. I got out of there after only 11 years, so, you know, you're making my count my blessings tonight.
Nice.
How was your weekend, Brooke?
Pretty good. Can't complain. I've been playing Amnesia a lot, which is cool. I got so close to 100%ing this game before reviewing it. I'm, like, right on the end here. That's all I did. It actually wasn't. That's all I did with my weekend. I was going to unsegue us, and I was going to elaborate that, like, I bought scented candles and, like, special treats for myself. I hadn't ever gotten scented candles before. I'm kind of new to candles, so I went to Bath and Body Works because I heard they're having, like, this huge candle sale, and I got a sugared lemon zest one. I'm actually burning that one now. It's pretty good. I got a peach tea one. That one's pretty cool. This one sounds pretentious, but it's iced dragon fruit tea candle, and it smells awesome. I basically went around the store and smelled a bunch of them 2 weekends ago for my birthday. It was my birthday present to myself. I got really high, went to the mall, smelled candles, bought a shitload of them.
You didn't eat any candles, did you?
I didn't, but I think about it, man. I really... I don't know about you, Aki, but when I was a kid, and I single out Aki here because I feel like she may have this in common with me. I was always eating weird shit. I'd eat like grass, candles. I'd eat like a crayon. I was one of those kids.
Yeah, when I was a little kid, I ate dirt, literally. I just grab a big old thing of dirt and just eat it, yeah.
I didn't know you ate dirt, but I knew you ate weird shit like me. I knew.
Oh, yeah.
Overall, the little weirdo
I still
kids.
Eat weird shit, just not dirt. I mean, just a couple years ago, I ate a sucker that had a scorpion in it, so...
Oh my god, I haven't had one of those yet,
I thought
but
you were about to say, like, 2 years ago, I had a crayon. It was pretty good still.
They're pretty good.
No, crayons are disgusting. Because I have eaten those.
Nothing's wrong with crayons, you just gotta peel the paper off.
No, you don't. That's perfectly edible, too.
That's true.
That's skin's got all the nutrients.
If you're already eating the crayon, you might as well eat the paper too.
Yeah, get a little fiber in there. Thank you.
It does. It's paper. It is actually it has fiber in it.
It is funny, not to get too far ahead of Brooke's review or anything, but like that she's talking about relaxing, like and lighting candles and playing Amnesia, and like because I'm not from the Otome spheres, I keep thinking Amnesia Dark Descent.
Everybody always does.
That's what I was thinking too until you said that.
I'm really glad that there's a much more famous like game franchise that goes by that name, because whenever I'm tweeting about it, and I tweet about this game like all the time, it's a cult classic in the Otome community, someone will always come in and like put screenshots from that game and to like troll me and the other Otome fans. It's pretty time-honored tradition for us. And I still have never played that game, so I kind of like never having a frame of reference for that.
Are there any good photoshops of like the two worlds combined?
That's a good question. I'm gonna shoot that question out later and ask, because that would be entertaining.
I was just looking through images of Amnesia Dark Descent, and somebody like made an Adventure Time like riff on it, which I don't like it, but at the same time I'm like, okay, yeah, I get this.
Cool. That's how I feel about a lot of fan art. I'm like, I don't like this, but I respect your game.
Yeah. Well, it's just somebody's Photoshop.
That's cool.
I'm dropping it in our Discord.
You should drop it in chat. Unless it's an NSFW one.
Oh,
then you should drop it in chat. No.
What about not safe for work?
It's on Pinterest. I'll drop the Pinterest link. And ooh, so cool. Y'all can support the artist whose name I didn't even read.
Oh, nice.
Amnesia Time. Oh, Lord.
Looks pretty cute.
I've only ever watched Amnesia being played. I've not played it myself, but it looks pretty cool. I like the monsters. They look good.
Cool.
So should we talk about your amnesia?
I guess the time has come.
Or Aki, how was your weekend?
It was great. I was playing my review games the entire weekend.
Did you have a favorite?
Not Embargo? Really. I just had one I didn't like.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's good.
Yeah, I was like, maybe I shouldn't be asking this. I'm just curious.
That's a tough question to ask us sometimes. Like, what did you think of the games you were playing all weekend? Can't tell you till Thursday.
Well, as long as I don't specify which games they were, it's fine.
Yeah, process of elimination. We'll figure it out eventually.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway. Whichever one I cussed at was the one I didn't like. There we go.
Yeah. Well, we should probably get to the reviews. We got a couple that we got to talk about, and then Pernell's going to be around later in the show. I'll be chatting with him for a couple of reviews as well. This is going to be a long episode. This is like back-to-back long ones. But first
we miss
game,
you, Ghost of Pernell. Wherever you are.
Ghost of Pernell.
You're still pretty good.
We're the social bicycling group, like getting ahead of Pernell.
Pernell, are you having fun?
Fucking yeah!
Fucking yeah, that's right, Pernell.
Yeah. Pernell actually would just probably take us all to town with his fitness abilities, honestly.
It's true, like, ironically. And
fucking
has awesome
yeah!
stamina. What I can only imagine is...
Pernelltergeist.
Really super long stride.
Yeah, I forget about that too, man.
He's a tall dude, so...
Yeah. I always piss people off when I'm walking with them if they're tall. 5'2", and my legs are like the shortest... Of all. Even among people who are my height, it's pretty bad.
See, and that's why I'm good to hang out with for short people, because I walk very slowly. I walk like a grandmother.
Nice. See, I knew there was something like about you. Nice.
Literally have been compared. Like, somebody's like, you walk as slow as my grandmother. And I'm like, hey, your grandmother is a nice person. And you can show
and we
some
take
respect.
Walks together frequently.
You're like, you should be so lucky, Sonny.
Yeah, exactly.
Should spend more time with your grandmother. Everyone should spend more time with your grandmothers if you got them.
Yeah.
But yeah, review. Should we get to them?
Let's do it.
Sure.
All right. First game to talk about is Amnesia Memories, developed by Idea Factory and Design Factory, published by Idea Factory International, released September 20th on the Switch for $49.99. In this Otome visual novel, you awaken on the 1st of August with no memory of your relationships or your past. A friendly spirit named Orion appears, somehow trapped within your consciousness. With his help, you must unravel the mystery of who you are while hiding your amnesia from those seemingly closest to you, or risk oblivion. Can you regain your memories and find your true love before it's too late? Brooke, how much time have you spent on this game?
If anyone who works with me is listening, less than 40 hours. If anyone who doesn't work with me is listening, this is a 50, 60 hour game on the low end, and I'm on some of the very last side endings here. So I almost set a little record for myself, 100%ing a game in a week in the amount of time I got to review it. Oh, came pretty close, maybe next time. But I love this game, and I played it so much, even though I played it 8 years ago. So that being said, as a gift to everyone present today, I will not be talking about this game for 5 hours, which I easily could. This is probably my number one favorite Otome game. If you're an Otome fan, it's a lot of people's favorites. Probably my number one favorite Otome game of all time, and also just one of my favorite games, period. Literally changed my life. I finished this game up when I was 27, cried my ass off, and I made some huge life changes. I'm serious. I like really changed me. This game and I go deep back to 8 years ago. And I'm honored to review it. But deep down, I did wonder if this game would hold up after all the years. And it did. I played so many Otome games since then. And this is my first big budget, like full feature Otome game. I played phone apps and stuff like that before, but I really didn't know it was coming in this game. And after so long, it still really delivers. It's a good one. I was crying when I got to the code to review this. I was posting on Twitter, oh, I can die now. My life is over in a good way. And that's kind of a joke, but it's important to me, and it's a cult classic for a reason. So I think it held up content-wise, and I've experienced almost every part of it again as a 30-something-year-old woman. The premise of this game is, as Joe said, you've got amnesia. You wake up one day, and you don't know who you are. You don't know what your name is. Everyone you're interacting with who's a part of your life, they're a stranger to you now. But yeah, so that's the premise of like 800 animes and mangas. Why do we care if a normal brunette person wakes up one day and has no memories and has to figure out who all these people are surrounding them, who are all attractive members of the opposite sex, each with a different hair color? We've seen this done so many times. Why is this special? Well, this, you know, first of all, this isn't a Otome game. It automatically makes it pretty special. But while this, you know, unlike other mini Otome games where the objective is to eventually flirt and kind of start dating one of the cast by the end of the route/game. In this game, in most of the routes, you wake up and you're already in a relationship with the person of the route. But while you're pretty cute, you weren't the greatest person, so your relationship is not going well. Also, for crazy anime reasons, you have a supernatural creature as a sidekick who no one can see but you. And for supernatural bullshit anime reasons, you're not allowed to tell anyone you have amnesia. So you have to go through this game, and it's kind of like, you know, it's borderline psychological horror game for sure. Mostly lying about the fact that you can't remember anyone you're interacting with. And it gets pretty deep. A nice feature of this game that I had totally forgotten about, even though a lot of the more graphic parts of this game are burned forever into my brain. Something I forgot about because it's been a minute. Each world you can visit representing a route or a sort of parallel timeline, sort of what's going on here, is themed after a suit of cards. And in each world, the characters will be the same, but their interactions together and their lives up to this point could be totally different. Your best friend in Spade World could be your murderer in Clover World. And don't tell me Clover is clubs, because I know that. Tell Japan, not me. I'm not double localizing this for you. But yes, that feature's really cool. This game has a lot of really nice details like that. This game was a good time for me, even now, out of context. Let me see here, scrolling down through my notes. So yeah,
how's
I played
the
almost.
Port?
The port is a great question. I've almost 100% of this game and seen almost every part of it. And the port works great. A lot of folks like me who are purchasing this again for the second or third time out of respect and nostalgia for one of the great pieces of art of our generation are wondering, hey, it's almost a decade later for this region, more like 15 years later for Japan. Does porting this game mean it's going to get new features, new UI, new options to update this game? The answer is no. It is the same UI, and we don't have any of the common upgraded features that a lot of visual novels will have now. We can skip text, which everybody knows that I and other visual novel players really enjoy, but we can't yet skip to the next choice. This is going to make more sense to Aki than maybe non-visual novel listeners. You can kind of fast forward through and watch the game to skip dialogue, but you can't just obliterate out everything to get to the next choice like you can in most modern nice visual novels. But if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Seriously, though, while that would have been great to be able to skip to the next option, it's stuff like that. It wasn't as much of a thing back in the day, and at the end of the day, the Otome genre doesn't have like an insanely big budget, so a port like this costs a lot of money, and I can understand why we didn't add features in like that, but I do wish we had that, and I was wondering if we were going to get it. Another thing we didn't get that I was wondering if we might be able to have, normally when you get to a special event in these games, you get a CG, a content graphic, a nice little anime picture of the scene that's not just the character shadow puppeted up on the screen behind whatever background the scene's in. A lot of times these scenes are pretty long and the CG will change and the character will like put their arms around you or blink or someone will start crying. A lot of games nowadays will have updated CGs where you can flip through the memory album of the game instead of replaying the scene and you can see all the pictures that you've unlocked by getting as far as you have into the game. This game doesn't have the updated CG option. It's still just the first one you see. If something else happens in the scene that changes it a little, you'd have to replay the scene to experience that CG again. But if we're wondering if it's well ported as far as quality goes, everything works perfectly. It does exactly what it says it's going to do. And I played this on PC back in the day. Most people have. It's come out for Vita too, but it, you know, it's clean, it's simple. It was one of the better visual novels that came out when it initially came out. And if we're judging it against those standards, it still is. And when it comes to visual novels that aren't at the very, very, very top of the budget here, it's still mostly got all those features that even the modern ones that are coming out today have. So I do think it's ported super well. I would have liked a couple more features, but I don't mind at all. But yeah,
what would, add? What would you do to make it an even better experience?
I would definitely add, like, I was really, these two stand out for me, the content graphic thing where I can see each iteration of the scene and not have to replay to see the special art in each way that I unlocked it. I'd love to have that. I'd love to have a skip all dialogue. But those are really the only things I can think of. Those are the only ways that I would improve it. So I actually can't think of anything else. And that's not a bad spot to be, especially for a game that's like, this has got to be close to 16, 18 years old in Japan.
Yeah, well, it's $50. Does it stand the test of time?
I think it does because this game is a big honking game. It has a lot of gameplay. It's got a ton of replayability. I don't really harp on whether we have a skip all text option if I'm not looking to replay the game many times. But if I'm over here 100%ing it after 8 years, a lot of people will be too. This is a game where a lot of people want to see every second it has to offer. And $50 isn't the very peak of the price point for like premium Otome games like this anymore. So they could definitely charge more for this if they wanted. I paid a cool 100.
Ideas, please.
I paid a cool $120 for the limited edition of this game, and combined with the sequel, which they're releasing on the same day, and some sweet merch. And I even told Joe, I was like, please tell Idea Factory I already bought this at the highest price point, so that they'll know I'll probably give it a good review. But yeah, I'm ready to say if I think it's missing any features. And those are the only two I can think of. And they're definitely not missing it compared to previous ports of the game. It just would have been a little bit nice to premium it out. But the game looks great. The sound design is just, everything's perfectly mixed. And the opening song that was written for this game is top notch. It sounds beautiful on the Switch. So
you want to know what else is beautiful? Stag Gorilla dropping more biddies in chat. Thank you, Stag.
Thank you. Thanks.
I hope this isn't like a vision of the future where it's just George's voice repeatedly dropping biddies.
That's pretty cool.
I love it. I love hearing George's voice scream just randomly while someone's talking, just out of the blue, dropping brr. Makes me laugh every time.
Good voice.
The funniest, though, is Raids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's really funny that like in today's internet, you know, if you think about versus like 20, you know, plus years ago, whatever, it's like people like it's now like a common practice for people to annoy each other with money.
I mean, people can annoy me with money all they want. I am fine with this. I would really like to spend like $500 on a model kit.
But if you would explain that to somebody who is on the early internet, like, yeah, someday somebody is just going to like spend a lot of money to support you because like you've got something set up where it's going to annoy you, you know, or it's going to annoy like other people.
Just imagine someone throwing handfuls of change at you while you're walking around.
Yeah. And it's not as much in this stream as I see a lot of the other streams, like, you know, partner gaming streams and stuff like that. It's just like every increment of money like equals some annoyance for, you know, the audience, which, again, I just think it's funny.
Fall into the abyss.
I think it's funny because I wouldn't have believed that. It would have been like, is this some Idiocracy shit? Like, this sounds like some dystopian sci-fi bullshit. Like, it's entertaining. But now that I'm here, I'm like, yeah, this is just what it's like now.
It's like, it's not. arguably could be, but it's like, not only is this going to be completely normalized, but this is going to be the preferred way to play, like, your Nintendo.
Yeah.
Awesome. I mostly play my Nintendo on stream, but I personally don't have the alerts and stuff by choice, but I just think it's funny that's the culture now.
See, I used to not have them, but it became more funny to be interrupted while I'm trying to do something with someone screaming at me. So
Yeah.
Or in the case of raids, hearing Jacob go fall into the abyss of my gaping butthole.
Wow. Exactly. And, you know, it's probably
that's my
just the
favorite one.
It's the combo of tired and caffeine that's making me, you know, all pontificate like this. I'm just like,
well, anyway, it's your turn because next game to talk about is Whatever Land, developed by Caligari Games, published by Caligari Games and Whisper Games, released September 15th on Steam for $19.99. Find your way out of a magical prison in this nonlinear point-and-click adventure full of mini-games and challenges. Get to meet the charismatic Whateverlanders, steal and deceive, or be a good boy to discover all the different endings of Vincent's story. Chris, what is going on in Whatever Land?
Okay, so Whatever Land, this is a point-and-click adventure in as much the tradition of, you know, that you, when you actually play the, when you start the game and it gives you the tutorial literally contains two words, and those are point, and it shows the mouse pointing, and then click, and then it shows the mouse clicking. And it's like, this is how you play the game, you point and you click.
Sounds rough.
Fair enough. Yeah, I know.
It's a lot to remember.
I know. And, you know, damn the kids nowadays needing these tutorials. No, in keeping with the modern traditions, this one also has a function where if you hold the space bar, it shows you all the hot spots, which I like. I always award points for eliminating the need to pixel hunt.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. And, you know, this game is actually kind of a little different. It's got a little bit of a different play on the old formula. So let's get into a little bit of the plot, because that's what we like in these games. So you are Vincent. You are a cat burglar who steals into a mansion late at night to steal an old lady's necklace from a glass display. And you are caught by said old lady, who turns out to be an ancient witch, and she sends you careening into another dimension. So it's a pocket dimension where this witch has sent people that she either does not like, or we find out through the course of the game and meeting other characters in this world, some quite voluntarily ended up in this world. So it's a good way to kind of get the this sense of, like, you know, here's a small world with a bunch of characters with different feelings about being here. You know, it's a great way to kind of bundle that up real nice. And so you basically wake up in a junkyard, literally inside of a fridge, and you start wandering around, and eventually your kind of tutorial set of dialogue and quote-unquote puzzle leads you to freeing and befriending your partner, who is Nick. And Nick is a floating Shakespearean ghost. That is to say, not a ghost from a Shakespearean play. I mean, he actually looks like William Shakespeare as a ghost. With splooshy black eye makeup. Everybody has, like, black eyeliner and black splooshy black eye makeup. I think it's, like, part of the curse or something, conveniently ends up giving this, like, a style.
I do appreciate that we're 2 for 2 on games that have ghost-like sidekicks.
Yeah.
Same.
And, And so your character and Nick kind of, you know, develop a little bit of a friendship over the course of the game, so it becomes a little bit of a buddy thing. Nick is eccentric but knows the lay of the land, and your character is a little bit more cynical, but depending on your choices, either easygoing or, you know, kind of more sarcastic and, you know, a little more, what would you call it? Not acerbic, but I don't know, let's just leave it at cynical. He is a career thief. And in that sense, like, you do have, basically the way that the puzzles and stuff work, it's less about collecting items and finding obscure ways to use them, and more like just walking around and talking to people, and like eventually either, you know, kind of tricking them out of like the thing that they have that you need, of which there are 7. Like, the game sets up the MacGuffins pretty well. They're like, we need 7 pieces of this thing in order to... Basically, they're trying to summon the witch to ask her nicely to send us back, literally. And so, like, you need 7 pieces of the spell or something like that. So, you know, the MacGuffins are laid out very plainly. And so the one way is to, you know, like, I guess sneak and thief and, like, you know, kind of trick your way into getting them. The other way is just to straight up challenge most of these folks to one of their mini games. Or collect the right items and stuff. And sometimes it'll just end up playing the mini game that kind of becomes like the second game. Like, you play it so often, at least as an option, that I just want to call it like the second game of the game. And it's called Bell and Bones. Bell and Bones is a mini game that you can play with other characters. Most other characters will have a dialogue option where you can play it with them, and certainly it's used a lot to like solve plot things. And it's a strategy game that is also like kind of a table football soccer kind of game. So you've got these little munchkin creatures who get their own backstory. You get to learn about them too. You know, some of them are like kind of insects. They're all the size of bugs, and like the goals are like spoons and things like that. Like, it's very much a tabletop game. And, you know, they each have, like, different moves that they can do along a hexagonal grid. So it's like a hexagonal strategy game where the goal is to get the character that has the ball over to a spoon so that they can score a goal and win the game. And, of course, there are traps, and there's a competing team, and, you know, there's all kinds of stuff in your way. It gets more and more complex as you play more and more characters. And there's another thing that the game graciously decided upon, and that is that in the regular game, you can collect balls of yarn in hidden places and or obscure places, sometimes in just plain old places, and if you use one of these balls of yarn in this game, you just win it instantly, because a cat comes and, like, messes with the game, and it defaults to you as the winner. So, you can summon a cat to make you win the second game anytime you want.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, so it's kind of like the point-and-click side of it, being like, okay, we have this other game, you don't have to play it if you don't want to, because we've given you point-and-clickers, like, some nice obscure little spots to find a way to, like, just skip this thing. But that is not to say there aren't other mini-games as well. Over the course of your adventure, you are going to, learn how to select fish, ultimately to learn how to cook ramen. But like, it's kind of funny because, like, the fish sorting game, like, you got to put the rotten fish in one bin and, you know, the fresh fish in another bin. But you also have to watch out for the fish that have human eyes, because they should also go in the bin because they used to be people and we can't eat them. So, like, you know, just a weird way.
I appreciate the features list on Steam mentions the mini games. It says loads of mini games, at least 2.
Yeah, I like that.
I mean, it's not wrong.
Underselling. So when you get there, it over delivers.
Yeah. So, you know, there's different, like, little puzzle, like, literally puzzles, like, you know, like the radar puzzle and things like that. The ramen game is also kind of a Cooking Mama-esque kind of game. There's also a game where you give a tattoo to somebody because that's what they want. They want a tattoo, and that's your job. And the kind of cool thing is that the game keeps track of all this with a nice little scrapbook where you can look at the characters, and it kind of like lets you know what they want, but it like looks like a scrappy, like, you know, scrapbook with like Polaroids and things like that. So that's kind of cool. There's a lot of style in this game. It is not only hand drawn looking, but it is like kind of a cel shaded 3D type of thing. So it ends up with this kind of 2.5D look where characters are talking and they look like hand drawn cartoons, but you can actually see they are kind of moving in a 3D space. And it makes the dialogues
actually look kind of cool.
Yeah, it makes dialogue look cool because, like, your character will be facing, and then when the other character's talking, they both kind of flip around where the other character is now talking, and, like, it actually is a flip, like, animation kind of thing. So, lots of good presentation here. Music's really, really good. It's very hokum, very jazzy kind of acoustic instruments and things like that. I have a couple of complaints.
Let's hear them.
Mostly, I'm going to complain about the voice acting. Now, the game was developed in Spain, and all of the dialogue, at least that I was listening to, is in English with, like, an accent. And that's not bad. The characters, you know, they're clear in their speech. Sometimes they're even good. Sometimes they actually will point out, like, you know, like, because one of the actors is, like, going for, like, a Southern California accent, but they also have their, you know, clearly European accent that they can't get rid of. So one of the characters will comment like, your accent's a little weird and things like that. And then, you know, you get to the ramen shop where every character is Asian and then it starts to fall apart and you're like, okay, these are definitely some Europeans who didn't get the memo that there's certain accents you shouldn't try to go for, especially in like a cartoon level. There's a jazz trumpeter called Louie, who I like the gimmick of the character in that he just mumbles and like you just have to read what he says. Like it's not actually any kind of language, except that you kind of do hear some words in there and they do have an accent in there somewhere. And then you're kind of like, ugh, I'm kind of on the border of being very bothered by this. But it's also they're doing a Louis Armstrong impression. So it's like they are specifically doing a specific impression of a person. But at the same time, you're kind of like, after the ramen restaurant, I'm kind of like not buying this. So, you know, the voice acting goes for some things that I don't approve of. However, for the most part, it seems pretty sincere and good. So, you know, take from that what you will. Writing can be a little weird. It does have some grammar errors and some like some weirdness. But again, I think for the fact that all the rest of the presentation is so good is only why sometimes the writing does kind of contrast with it. And also, it's not a hilarious game. I mean, the first character that you run into after meeting your, you know, eccentric sidekick is a guy who is kind of a reflection on the fact that no character in the game can die. So this character's constantly trying to commit suicide. And he's drawn out like a very tragic, emo-y kind of, you know, with the flippy hair and stuff kind of character, and he's just very sad, and you're kind of like, okay, am I supposed to find this character funny or tragic or a reflection? Because like the very next scene, like we're yucking it up in a bar with like some other characters, so it's kind of like, okay, what tone am I, you know, what is there a consistent tone in whatever land? And like for the most part, a lot of it is kind of just funny like and character driven, but like initially you aren't getting that sense because they throw this like dour character at you and there's kind of no reason for him. So I'm like, okay, well, all right. So, you know, it's not like a perfect kind of game in that sense, but at least I thought highly enough about the things that were good about this that like, you know, I did actually have to sit and ponder the things that I think are kind of lacking. So.
Yeah.
Also, the game has 2 save spots, and it's a point and click. What the hell?
Oh, my God. That is not okay.
You need more save spots.
Come on, yeah. Y'all.
But, you know, again, it's also not a Sierra game. You're not like, you know, you're not, I don't think this game has a no-win scenario. So it does have multiple endings, so it's kind of like, you know, you're not, you got
guess you'll find out
game if you want. Yeah, exactly.
And, $20 on Whateverland. What do you think?
Well, given everything, I'm going to say that kind of on its face, it's a pretty good buy it for a interesting point click in an interesting world. It's not my favorite though, and you know, it didn't resonate with me as much for the fact that, like, again, it's not as funny as it could be. But they did try so hard that I'm like going to put it on the high end of a try it, branching into the low end of a buy it.
Sounds good.
You know, just to kind of get the experience. It's teetering in that 75% to 80% kind of
nice
area. Yeah, so there you go.
Cool. Well, next game to talk about is To Leave, developed by Freaky Creations, published by Red Deer Games, released September 9th on Xbox One and Switch for $19.99. Soar through over 80 gorgeously designed maps using Harm's Flying Door. It's your pathway and only means of transport. Remember, they are very fragile and need to be treated with the utmost care. Travel through the dark void, discover hidden meanings and symbolism weaved into the gameplay. Challenge yourself and understand the heartbreaking truth about harm. Aki, what is going on in To Leave?
Okay, you play as a young man named Harm. And apparently his girlfriend, Faye, died, and now he's constantly high, it appears.
Hey, nothing's wrong with that.
Yeah, yeah. One of the first things you see him doing is going into a magical world and floating around and macking on this giant fairy lady. And then the very next thing you do is you see him, like, mixing up this weird sludge drink that he drinks and then gets incredibly fucking high. and I believe that is the state he is in the entire game, I believe.
Okay, so what do you do in the game?
You go into... You start off in his room, and then he has this magical door... That's this purple glowing door that is clearly not normal. And from there, he goes around in this other little world to different levels of the game. And in those levels, he kind of platforms. He jumps around and his door flies him places. And it's treated very much like Flappy Birds, I think is what it's called, where you have to keep tapping the button and it just raises it. And when you're not tapping the button, it falls, and that kind of gameplay sucks. And, you know, at first it starts off, you know, you just have to go through this area. You're collecting these weird fire things, which I think are supposed to be souls, maybe, because you have a certain amount of power, and it's constantly draining from you, and you don't start off with a lot. And once it's all drained from you, if you get hit by something... You die and you have to start the level all the way back at zero. Because when you die, you have to feed your magic door part of your soul.
Makes sense.
Yeah, from reading some of his journals and stuff, it seems like you can only do that 7 times. And then maybe it's game over. I'm not really sure. But basically, you have to Flappy Bird your way through this level collecting souls. And you can't touch any of the walls, the ground, anything. There's only these weird squares, purple squares that have faces on them that you can land on. And they are little checkpoint areas. So, you know, anytime you touch something or something hits you, you'll be teleported back to there until you've run out of energy and then died and went back to the house and have to restart the entire fucking thing all over again. So it eventually gets harder. You know, things start firing at you.
I like how you say it's Flappy Bird gameplay and then it gets harder.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
That doesn't sound very fun.
Oh, you noticed that. Okay, good. I'm glad you noticed. You know, at first it's not too bad because you're not like going through just hopping up and down, dodging around pillars and just moving one direction. In this, you're, you know, going up and down literally throughout this whole level, not specifically dodging anything. So it's not quite 100% Flappy Birds, but the way it moves is like Flappy Birds, where you have to constantly tap a button to get it to raise more and more and more. But eventually you get areas where things are firing. They fire in a straight line, but you have to dodge those or else they hit you and you go back to the prior checkpoint. As you collect the souls thing, you get more power And it just, it continually forever builds up. As long as you keep grabbing them, you'll just get more. There's no limit. Like, you don't stop at 100% energy. However, any of them you collect, if you die, you go back to the checkpoint. Those do not show back up. Granted, you still have however much energy you died with, minus some for getting hit. So you still have a bunch more. However, the more you fail at that same part, the more fucked you are, because that's how the game decided to give you the middle finger. yeah. Eventually, you know, you get blocks that chase after you, and they believe in the concept of momentum. In other words, the longer, the further away from you they are and move toward you, the faster they move. Whereas you do not have that concept of momentum makes me go fast. So yeah, it's, yeah, that's a thing. We're just going to go with that, because otherwise I'm going to have a long string of obscenities.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. And in later levels, the areas between checkpoints is very long, and you have a lot of said bullshit to deal with. And I quit at level 8 out of, I think they're supposed to be like 11. And I said, fuck it, I'm done. I'm not playing this ever again. So wow. I didn't even finish 8. Yeah, no, I gave up. I was like, no, I fucking hate this. This is misery inducing at this point. I'm fucking done. And well, it's because I spent over an hour on that one fucking level, and I just would rather blow my fucking brains out.
Relatable.
Yeah.
Well, it's $20. What's your verdict?
No.
I'm sorry.
No. No. If they want to make this a tentative buy it, they need to do some serious work, namely respawn the energy things so that you can continue to get energy every time you go back to the fucking checkpoint. That way you're not just being punished over and over and over until you literally cannot win because you keep getting punished at the same section and constantly are just running out of power until you eventually just die, which is bullshit. And to add more fucking checkpoints.
Yeah, this one sounds like a tough one.
Yeah, I spent around an hour, maybe two, on level 8, and I hit 3 checkpoints.
It takes a lot to make you tap out on a game, too. You've gone through some shit.
Yeah. I think this is one of 2 games that I decided, fuck it, and I'm not going to go back to this unless they change it. I am so glad that I have, you know, padding throughout my insulation in my house so people didn't hear me screaming obscenities at this game. I'm starting to get red faced just talking about it because it's making me angry.
Rook, did you hear her from the bushes outside?
I did. I wasn't going to say anything because I don't want to embarrass her right now, but, you know, you just had to call her out on live air.
Thought it was 2 cats fighting.
Next time, when the bushes just come in.
Okay. That ruins the fun.
I don't know about that. There could be a lot more fun had elsewhere, but.
All right. Well, can only go up from here. And things are going up big time because the last game that we're going to talk about is Kaichu, the Kaiju Dating Sim, developed by Squitter Shins, published by Top Hat Studios.
Oh boy.
Released September 7th on Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, PS4, PS5, and PC for $9.99. Kaichu is a dating sim about Kaiju. You play the role of Gigachu, a gigantic romantic looking for love. Meet 6 other eligible Kaiju and visit 24 famous landmarks where Gigachu will answer challenging compatibility questions to decide the fate of your relationship. Brooke, what is going on in Kaichu?
Well, I ended up just talking a lot during the interview, so I was going to let Aki start us out on this one.
Aki, what's going on in Kaichu?
Because here's my review notes. Just listen to the interview. It's in all caps.
I mean, we did go for 90 minutes last episode.
Really good interview, honestly.
Yeah, that did pretty much answer everything we could have said about the game, I think, was said during that.
Yeah, but, and I know we gotta re-review it now, but like, if you're all, what I really want to say more than anything is, if you're interested in this game, that was an awesome review. I just think it's like, from a developer standpoint, yeah, like I just, you know, it goes really deep. It goes way deeper than this game goes, which is pretty deep. So if you're listening,
it was fun too. They like they kept us entertained the entire time. Yeah. It was just good conversation. You don't always run into that challenge or talking with indie devs. Sometimes you get the really nervous and unchatty ones, and it takes a lot to get something out of them. But that was a really fun chat.
Yeah, it was really organic.
Nice.
So, we know what the game is about. Is it fun?
Yes.
Fucking describe it, Aki.
No. Yes.
Okay, in this you play as this giant Godzilla-looking thing, except for it's pink and it has hearts, and it's cute.
So cute.
Yeah. And basically, you go around. The very first thing is you go around, you figure out which one of these other giant kaiju, which are giant monsters for the few of you who somehow don't know what the fuck a kaiju is, and you figure out which one of them you want to date. And some of them are super cute, and some of them are like three-headed hydras. Literally. And but then after you... Cute. Yeah, well, some of them are cute, some of them are guys. And once you've figured out which one you settle on, you go and talk to them. And then at that point, you go and you destroy a national monument somewhere, wherever you want, because the whole world is open. And you can just find a monument and say, okay, fuck this monument in particular. Let's destroy it. And that
you know, things like Tokyo Tower, the Sydney Opera House.
Yeah.
Mount Rushmore that Brooke really enjoyed beating the shit out of.
Oh, we obliterated that.
Rushmore. The first one memories. I always destroyed was the Sydney Opera House.
I actually didn't see that one like until the game was almost over for me. I was like, oh, shit, there's something down here.
Well, hell, every time you continue the game, you start near it.
Yeah, I just missed it.
So you go and you start destroying a tower with your deity, and that turns them on, apparently. And basically, you go through a multiple choice little quiz thing, and every answer you have impacts how the other kaiju sees you. Some of them they're super happy with because it shows you're super compatible with them, and the both of you do special fire breathing in your case, and them it's a special attack that's whatever based on what kind of kaiju it is, so they're all kind of different. Or, you know, it's just a little compatible, not super good, but it's still on the better end, and then they'll punch or kick the shit out of the thing. Lazily
punch the thing. I love that one. It's just like,
yeah.
Yeah, we're finishing dinner, you know, throwing in the emotions.
Yeah. Oh, wow. We've learned something new about Rook today. And then sometimes you get the really bad answers that are like, we are not compatible the fuck at all. And then they turn away from each other and look totally dejected. Or there's the not particularly compatible ones where they just kind of look down like, oh, well, okay, I guess. And yeah, that's really what the game is you just go through that, and each act, there's three acts in the game. The first one is you have to reach a certain level of, you know, being compatible with them. The second one, you know, the army decides to send a robot thing to try and break you up. And then the third one is you guys trying to deal with the robot thing together. I assume you can fail this. I never managed to fail it because I'm really suave when I want to be, which I know is outstanding to everyone here hearing how I talk regularly, but I'm really good at it when I want to be. So I never actually had any of them be like, we're breaking up properly. So I assume there is a pathway where you do that, and in which case I assume you just find someone else to date.
Yeah, that's Jacob and I. Jacob and I are not suave like Aki. Let me just throw this in there if you missed the interview. Jacob and I had to like start over and got friend zone. Aki, meanwhile, never failed. So it just goes to show you.
And the irony being, I dated both of them that each one of them dated. I succeeded where they failed.
That's actually true. People,
you hussy.
Yep. Homewrecker.
Some people just have a higher emotional intelligence when it comes to giant monsters.
That's true. And I was trying to make it work, and you know, it just wasn't a great fit. So if you really love someone, let them go and let Aki have them.
Exactly.
Brooke, what are your thoughts on the game?
Oh, I love this game. You know, if you did hear our interview, I just couldn't shut up about it. I gushed about it. One thing I thought was interesting that I mentioned in the interview is Aki and I both of us have played like a ton of dating games, anime dating games, you name it. But this was different. I probably haven't. And I'm going to get on that right after the show. Actually, I'm going to get back in there for some Amnesia later crowd. But anyway, I thought this is different. This is more of like a compatibility test game. And yeah. I thought it was really cool because a lot of the questions get really deep and a lot of them are rooted in the devs' own experiences and questions. One of the devs is like a psychology major in school.
So am I, which is probably why
so
I'm good at
cool.
This.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, yeah. Now I'm thinking you're metagaming it over here. I shouldn't be beating myself up about being friends. No, I shouldn't. I thought it was cool. Like, I bring that up because I thought it was a nice mix between like there are deep questions like, hey, do you have a fear of rejection and how do you act out about that, blah blah blah, those kind of like deep real questions, but they'll also always bring it home to the humor. This is a really funny game and it's about monsters digging each other by like destroying property. So one of the questions is, you know,
so it's like human dating basically.
Yeah, pretty much like that. But one of the questions that I had with Megaricus, the monster I dated, like they were like, how do you feel about concrete? How do you feel about concrete? And we were both like, boo, concrete sucks. And we got like a bunch of compatibility for that. And then they're like, all right, how about wood? And we're like, love wood. Wood's the best. The best. It's just the greatest. And then we became much closer after that. And I thought that was really funny. I thought it was really cute.
There's one interesting mechanic about this game that you probably didn't notice, but based on how compatible your answers are, actually determines how many questions you are asked and what questions you are asked.
Ooh, I did not notice that. And I love that I'm learning this now after playing this game a whole bunch and then like being in that long interview. I love that I'm learning something new right now from you.
Yeah, if you only get lukewarm and not great answers, you actually get more questions in order to try and bring your compatibility up, or I guess fuck up utterly and completely. There is only so many questions it will ask before it's like, we're done.
Wow.
But you can get as few as I think like 4 or 5 questions. And if you answer them all really good, you're done. Because you've already destroyed the monument. Because depending on what your answers are, also determine how destroyed the monument is by the time you're done. So if you answer really good, it doesn't take very long to destroy the monument. And at that point, obviously, the date's over. Whereas if you answer just medium-wise constantly, either good or bad, you get more questions and the date might end before the monument is turned to nothing but rubble. Whereas if you answer badly, the monument's probably still standing utterly and completely because you have failed to destroy it.
Yeah, if you're having a good time, y'all tear that shit up. It's over.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic.
I thought the graphics were great, you know, talking about the different stages of the monument. I just want to touch base on it. I like it. It's a simple game. Like, there's not a ton going on. There's not like crazy 3D graphics or like a first person view or anything. It's still a 2-day game, but it's really like charmingly made. Everything it's works cute. Super well. And I love the color scheme. Like, you know, the main character you're playing as is the giant pink Godzilla-esque dinosaur with the hearts. But everybody kind of has their own like... neat is that lots of pinks and purples and blues. I love that shit. And I think the map looks cool too. The parts that are animated are just clean. You know, I feel like they did a lot with what they had. And it just like the way I opened up that interview with all of us was like, hey, my first thoughts are this just feels like a really completed project. One, it feels like it's not your first game. Two, it feels like you had a realistic idea and really went for it. And like, if there was anything they said they didn't have time for, basically I was going to be surprised. Whereas it normally is the opposite way, where people are like, hey, I wanted this and that, but I ran out of time. I definitely respected this project. I wanted to play it out of curiosity either way. And getting a couple hours into it, you can see that it's full of heart. It's deep. It can be emotional if you want to take that from it, but it doesn't berate you over the head with that. And it stays really funny. I think this game's hilarious. It's narrated by two newscasters who are like, hey, this just in, giant monster is over here. And they'll sort of narrate your way throughout the whole journey of you meeting the other monster and the military interfering and even giving interviews to the newscasters. They're like, oh, we're coming at you live from their next date. And both newscasters are really, really funny, really well written. So I went into it thinking it was just like a haha, good time. Oh, cool. This will be a little monster dating simulator. And not only was it a different game, a different dating game mechanically than anything I'd ever played, even though it's simply done, it really surprised me. I think it's really entertaining.
I'm going to add in that there are only 6 saves to this game.
Oh my God, however, why did they do this?
However, there's also only 6 beasties that you can date. So okay, each one is enough. Basically, each save is basically made to be like, oh, dating this monster. Oh, you're dating this other monster, so on and so forth. Because
and it's not like the games are long, so you could just delete one and start fresh. You know, you could do a playthrough in 25, 30 minutes if you're quick.
Yeah.
And the reason why this is perfectly fine is all the information you unlock about each creature, because you do basically as you complete the game and do well on the dates, you unlock basically a dating profile for that one, and you unlock more and more parts to it. And even if you start a new game, all that information carries over.
Oh, I actually didn't know that, because I'm a one monster monster. I went for Megaricus. They friend zoned me. I couldn't get it through my head, so I just tried again, and I didn't try to date anyone else, so I had no idea.
You're like a regular monogamera over here.
Nice.
And good. If anyone's wondering what what's the monsters are, there's Tempra, who is a feminine volcano. There's Megaricus, who is a feminine space mushroom thing. There's Queen Hydra, I think was her name, who is a three-headed Hydra. I mean, that's pretty basic.
I like how we spent 90 minutes on this game and we're still spending so much more time than we should be.
Yep.
We had a good time with this one.
$10, what's your verdict?
I didn't get the name of the other three. Fuck you. Buy it.
Buy it. If this sounds mildly entertaining to you, you're going to love it. If you're looking for a fresh, you know, unique, if you will, experience, this actually is it. You know, I don't want to repeat too much from the interview, but my final thoughts are, I went into this thinking, oh my gosh, yet another dating game where the twist is we date monsters. Like, we have this so many times. If you are somebody who liked had a full boyfriend or something for the novelty, this is going to give you more novelty because it's actually a different type of game. And as Joe said, it's not a huge time investment. So I think it's a buy it all around. And normally when I rate dating games, I say this is a buy it if you like dating games. But I think this is a cute experience. If it looks mildly entertaining to you, just grab it. Because not only is it worth the time and the money, I think you'll be supporting great artists. And if you listen to the interview, you'll believe me.
Yeah, so go listen to the interview.
Yeah.
That is it for you three. We're going to take one more quick break, and I'll be back with Pernell. Does anyone have any final words to wrap this portion up?
The other three monsters are armadillo, an eagle, and a moth.
Oh, hell yeah. I think
fuck you, Joe.
Wow. I really enjoyed that. Please say hi to Ghost of Pernell. What do we got? Pernell Tergeist.
I love it.
Tell him we miss him more every moment.
Welcome back. We got one more segment of the show to take care of, and for this one, we are bringing in our good friend Pernell Vaughn. Pernell, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Had a good couple of days, spent some time in Philadelphia, but of course, as per the course, coming home, there was construction that blocked up the entire damn highway because, yeah, that makes total damn sense on a Monday, on a weeknight or whatever, so... But I had some banh mi. I had some freaking Cantonese food, which I'd never had before. I walked a lot, a whole lot. Saw the Liberty Bell.
What brought you to Philly? What made you go there?
Oh, I had some friends come to visit from Chicago. And it was like that one of those things we could just kind of do. It was like, you can check out Philadelphia. I can show you around. We can do stuff. But it's always funny because since I'm just me by myself, I don't generally travel to Philadelphia all that often. Like, it's not because I dislike it, but I just hate parking there. So unless I have an actual event or solid reason to want to go in, I just don't go. So it's nice, though, when people come to visit and they want to go, because it gives me an excuse to get off my butt and travel there. I get to see stuff that I wouldn't see otherwise. So he just wanted to see the Liberty Bell. I was like, okay, well, I can take you there. I know where it is. So walked around, found the Liberty Bell. So the downside was, like, after walking down South Street, which it looked really cool. He liked seeing South Street. We then went back to my car and had to drive across South Street to get him to their hotel. And while we were out there, we just saw some random group of guys, like, just trying to, like, Bim was trying to, like, abuse this guy in the middle of the street. And we were trying to peg what the hell was even going on. Dude's pants were so far down, you could see his actual ass. Like, not his underwear, but his literal ass. And you're like, what the hell are you doing? But, like, he was pretty much, like, tried to push a guy and, like, try to punch him in the face in the street, and the guy, like, dodged him and, like, ran off. And I think he was just trying to do some intimidation bullshit. Which just made me look and go, these guys came here. I gave them the tour of Philadelphia. It was like, Philadelphia is awesome. And they see your old stanky ass. Like, now you ruined the fucking trip.
Now they got to see what Philly really is.
Yeah, pretty much. It's like, I showed them the sweet stuff, and this fucker ruins it. Though, truth be told, though, like, Philly... in many spots is really nice. It's just douchebags come out of the woodwork, like in any major city, really. Like, douchebags like to come out of the woodwork and just fuck it up for everybody, but they can't ruin an overall good thing. It's just, unfortunately, some people are unlucky, like that one guy, and you have to stumble across Douchebag McGee, and we just have to deal with the brunt of it, so. But, all in all, it still proved to be a good trip for these guys. They enjoyed their time here, and they are already looking forward to coming back to visit again. Might be able to get them to come to PAX Unplugged, which would be nice. Ooh. So we'll see.
That's the board game centric one, isn't it?
Yes. It's my favorite one now. Like, I've kind of tapered off of every convention but PAX Unplugged. Something about being there. It's like, board game conventions are like the easiest ones to do. Not to say they're easy, because every convention is tough to do in the grand scheme of things. But when you lay it on the table, video game conventions, to run those, you got to get all kinds of electricity going properly. You got to get you don't want to have any shorts out. You got to have a bunch of game consoles that are expensive TVs, enough controllers for each one. You got to make sure they're locked down so people don't steal shit because, you know, people fucking suck. You know, it's a lot that goes into that. A board game convention, you just need tables and some games and a door that won't let people walk out with a giant box that isn't theirs. And that is surprisingly easy to set up if you have the right connections to get the goods. You don't have to worry about logistics as far as, like, electrical circuits goes, shortages of stuff. You can always get more tables and chairs as long as you got the space, which, shock, that's what convention centers are for. Like, it's just great. You don't have to worry. I mean, like, think about it. I mean, it doesn't happen often, I'm sure, because when you go, like, say, for example, MAGFest, you go to MAG for, like, the concerts and stuff. But imagine you went for the video game component, right? And you're trying to walk around and find a game to play. Yeah,
I haven't been to MAGFest for the video game. Actually, to be fair, in recent years, I go for the indie games.
Yeah, those indie lots are solid. I love those.
It's good to see what games are coming up, who we could feature on the show, like who we could bring on. It's cool to see games that are at MAGFest, and then a year or two later, we're playing them on the show.
It's where I discovered that I can't remember the exact name, but it was like East of Eden or Far From Eden, that Mega Man Battle Network, like, you know, video game, node traveling game, which was fucking amazing. But yeah, like, I definitely get that. One Step From Eden? There it is, One Step From Eden. I love that game. I'm just old now, so I forget titles sometimes. God, I hate getting
I don't even know if that's the name. I'm just guessing.
No, that's it. It sounds right. It's one step from eating. It's not far step from eating, because that would be dumb. So it's definitely one step from eating. Yeah. But that game was great, and I learned about it from MAGFest. Also, there was that one game about the guy who's running on the back of dragons. That was a pretty cool game when I played it there. I know it came out, but I never got to play the final release. But yeah, MAG has got tons of cool stuff there, and I appreciate it for that. But
Onsen Master was a game that was at MAGFest. So.
Which one?
Onsen Master, that we just had the chat for.
I didn't know that was featured there. I didn't know they had it in MAG, but goes to show you, good shit comes out of MAGFest. But
yeah,
I only mentioned it because like the idea of like going into the game rooms and wanting to play something. Like, if they had popular games, they have to have, like, a bunch of machines, expensive machines, so that everyone can play it, or you have to sit there and wait for your turn for, like, the one or two. And generally, popular games, you're waiting a while watching people play stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas a board game setup is, like, you just need a table and a bunch more games. Okay, more people want to play. We need another game. What do you need? How much is the game? Not much. You don't need to get another TV. You don't need to get another console. You don't need to get an arcade machine. You just need another box. And you just throw it out there and you play it again if you want to.
Like, what if you run out of board games?
You get more. There's like tons of vendors there who sell them. Like,
what if you run out? What if they're all gone?
There was time.
Do you just run to Walmart and pick up Sorry?
I love how you're like naming like this Twilight Zone scenario. There was time to game. Now I'm out of games to play. No. Guy crying in the middle of the fucking Philadelphia Convention Center. There was time. Had all weekend off from work and they're out of games. But yeah, they will never fucking run out of board games. If anything, board games have hit a freaking like peak point. Like they're just exploding right now. And it's scary to see because board games have become like video games in that there are just too many. You want to play and own everything. And then there's even worse, like video games have, like, say, think about PC games, right? Like, PC games will be like, okay, well, in order to play this PC game, you need a computer that can run X specs or whatever, right? Board games equivalent now is a table space. You need a table that can handle X amount of space. I played a game this weekend that I want to buy, but I won't because none of my tables can accommodate it. I had to play it at a freaking board game cafe that gives you a giant tatami table to sit at.
Oh,
just
Lord.
To play this fucker.
What game?
It's called Ark Nova. You're basically building a zoo, but it is a hefty fucking game. It took the guy who taught us yesterday an hour and 10 minutes to teach us how to play it.
Jesus.
And then the game took 2 hours to play. I think 2.5 hours
to play. You spent 3.5 hours on one game.
And it was a fucking blast. That's
God
the
damn.
Thing.
How much is this game?
How much is it? Like money-wise? I want to say it retails for like $80 or $90.
Damn.
But like, it's a huge box. It's got tons of stuff in it. The replay value is through the goddamn roof. And when you're done, you will feel satisfied and tired because your brain will melt. There's just so many. You're trying to make these crazy decisions and balance things back and forth and all that. But it's such a good game. It is really good. I was thinking it was an overhyped game, and I hate making that statement because, in my opinion, overhype really isn't a thing. It's just a lot of people happen to like it simultaneously, which somehow people consider it overhyped, which is you can't tell a bunch of people they can't like something. But nonetheless, I was like, is this just a following a matter of like people liking the new hot thing or whatever, or is this game really meaty? And I finally got to play. I was like, holy shit, this game is great. I feel happy. I got the shit kicked out of me, but I had fun trying and then getting the shit kicked out of me. Yeah, but it was good. You know, now I want it, but there's no point in buying it because I can't, which is why it was nice. I also, the next day, I came across a board game cafe while we were walking around Philadelphia, just stumbled across it. And we played it again there, and he had a table that could accommodate it. So now I'm like, I could just pay these guys $7 a trip and just play the game when I want. And by the time I reach the amount of money the game costs, I'll have already been bored of it. I'll have played it out. I was like, yeah, there we go. That's the magic.
The one board game I want to get my hands back on is HeroQuest because they re-released it.
HeroQuest has a following, man. Like I'd heard of it back in the day, but hadn't played it.
I used to play it with my dad all the time. Me, my dad, and my brother would just go through. I had I think the Dwarven Barbarian, whatever it was, that made it through like every campaign. He never died. And I was so proud of that character.
Now, the one thing I don't remember about HeroQuest, because I was about to say, I only played it for the first time at, like, Retro World, like, back in, like, 2019 or something. But did it actually have a campaign mode in it? Like, you can make a character, beat a map, he levels up, and you take him to the next campaign?
It came with, I think the base game came with 10 campaigns that you would go through. And then they had expansion packs with, like, 5 or more, something like that. But yeah, you would just go through a campaign. A campaign would take like an hour or two. You would just like explore the map and the dungeon master would place what's going on. And yeah, you could carry your character over from game to game and just keep them going.
I like the sound of that, to be honest with you. Very much so, in fact.
One of the big things that keeps me from board games, though.
Humans.
Yes.
Or access to humans.
Friends.
Trust me, you're not alone in that. Like, it's, you might be like, well, Pernell, well, clearly that's a lie because you actually play games with people. And like, while that is true, it's still like this, like, sort of, it's like video games, really, right? Like, I can have a ton of multiplayer games, but if you don't like them, who the fuck cares? You're not going to play them with me. Hey, I got this really cool sports game. You want to play with me? I don't fucking play sports games. So next thing you know, you got a group of people you're hanging out with, and all they want to play is fucking Cards Against Humanity. When you want to play something that makes you, I don't know, do something.
Hey, so, I like Cards Against Humanity.
I didn't say I disliked it.
I said I wanted to do something. A night playing that.
I didn't say I disliked it. I said I wanted to do something. Cards Against Humanity has a purpose. And Cards Against Humanity's purpose is to give you a general activity when the alternative is sitting around staring at fucking walls. Because that's why I bought the game. Like, it. Because, I mean, think about it. Like, Cards Against Humanity, there are no rules. You literally just play a card that has a joke that someone else wrote, and everyone laughs at it. And that's fun. That's fun. But it also has you, you don't have to do anything. You just play a card and laugh. Mm-hmm. And that's the purpose it serves, and it's good. It livens up the room as a party. But if I'm like, you know, I want to play a game. Like, I want to, like, you just heard me talk about the last game I played. Like, if I want to play a game, and everybody in the room just wants to play Cards Against Humanity. Exactly. Yeah. So it's like, if it comes down to like, hey, we only want to play this, I'm like, okay, I'll play and I'll make the best of it. But deep down, I'll be sitting there going, man, I wanted to play fucking Ark Nova tonight. Everybody wants to play Cards Against Humanity. God damn it. So,
well, how's this question? Did you want to play Temtem?
I guess so. Funny thing, that's probably, I think that's a slogan that the game actually fucking has.
Do you want to play Temtem?
Yeah, like, even like maybe like their song or like one of their like advertisements. I was like, you want to play Temtem? I'm like, yes, I do. You just gave the review right there. Pernell, do you want to play Temtem? Yes. If I didn't like the game, I'd have told you, no, I won't play fucking Temtem.
All right, next game to talk about tonight. we should probably get to the reviews. God damn, this episode's going to be long. You ready?
Let's get down to business. Reviews will be pretty quick, thankfully. So
no, they won't. First game to talk about tonight is Temtem, developed by Crema, published by Humble Games, released September 6th on Xbox Series X and S, Switch, and PS5 for $44.99. Every kid dreams about becoming a Temtem tamer, exploring the 6 islands of the airborne archipelago, discovering new species, and making good friends along the way. Now it's your turn to embark on an epic adventure and make those dreams come true. Pernell, did you become a master Temtem tamer?
I fucking didn't, because I don't have all the time in the world for that.
Is this game?
So I'm going to cut to the chase and just cut the fat out of the way. Temtem is basically is Pokemon in the story element, in the sense where it's like, yeah, there's some more serious plot points and all that for different story bits. But at the core, the narrative is you're exploring the world to become a Temtem master. You got to beat the dojo masters and stop the evil team. Like, that is the norm. That is Temtem in that scope. I just wanted to get that out of the way, because a lot of people probably hear about this game and they already think it's just another wannabe Pokemon game. I bet it's got the same story beats. Well, aside from the way they wrote the story being that's a little more serious at times, those are the beats. However, what is the game? And that is where they thankfully differ very much, in a way that I, a person who's been playing Pokemon for hundreds of hours, for years now, has been able to pick up on and enjoy. So, you are running around this game's world, made up of like the 6 different biomes, So think of them as like, you know, like I said, biomes, like different like environmental regions, the water region or the water-esque region, the fiery region, the sandy region, whatever. And in each of those regions, there are different types of Temtem that you can come across in battle. Just like in Pokemon, Temtem have one to two different typings, and the typings have strengths and weaknesses to them. They have normal named ones like, you know, electric and wind and such, but there's also other ones like crystal and digital. So they try to shake it up a bit by like changing up some of the terminology and all, but at the end of the day, they're types with strengths and weaknesses. Now,
and it all comes down to like rock, paper, scissors with those things. This exactly. beats one, this beats another, the other beats the first, and mm-hmm. it's a cycle.
Yes. So, and I'm okay with that because, I mean, at the end of the day, I've always liked that concept anyway. It gives you reason to change
and switch them up. If it broke, don't fix it, right?
Damn right. It works. And the thing about, but here's the sweet thing about this. I think the whole point with these guys was that they kind of did do that still. It's like, you know, the don't fix if it ain't broke. But the thing is, Pokemon technically isn't broken, but that doesn't mean it can't be better. And one thing I like about how these companies come out with these new games is that a lot of people like to call them Pokemon clones and knockoffs. I like to think of it as people who have been playing Pokemon, seeing that Game Freak has been very stagnant and improving their games beyond just adding more Pokemon and adding a new gimmick. So these guys go, we can do better. Let's try. And this game takes a solid swing at it, and I think it hits. So let's go down the line with some of the things I recognize about the game that I thought were pretty freaking cool. So let's start with the basics, the attacks, right? So just like in Pokemon, every Temtem can have four attacks at a time. After you level up to a certain point at times, you can learn new attacks. And when you learn the attack, you swap one out for another. Normally in Pokemon, if you wanted to regain an attack you already learned, which is always what makes this freaking decision of what attack to keep such a strenuous one, well, in that game, you would have to go to the move relearner and give them a limited item that you have to find or farm to have more of just to relearn one move. In this game, you just have a list of the ones you learned already, and you just put the fucker back when you want to use it again. It's
That's like handy.
It does the right try. It makes sense because the whole point of it, it's not about forcing you to do a bunch of pointless legwork to get a new move, an old move back. It's literally saying moves are about what you have in battle proper. You have access to four moves in battle, but you can retool them however the frig you want in between battles in case you didn't like your loadout. That's fine. I like that. The next thing they did that was pretty cool about battles is that in this game, at least, every battle is broken down to 2x2. There are no 1v1 battles. Some people might hear that and go, that's dumb. I like my 1v battles in Pokemon. My response is, you're wrong. Jokingly, of course. Everyone likes what they like. But my opinion was that Pokemon, one of their best improvements over the years was when they finally switched over to 2v2 battles in Ruby Sapphire, because it opened up dimensions for more combat strategies. But due to the fact that they also had to always have that 1v1 mechanic, they couldn't use it to the fullest for certain things. This game, since it's a requirement, they were able to lean in hard on it. And one of the things that they did here that I liked is they have synergy attacks. So you might have an attack, let's say it has like an attack of like 50, and it has, you know, poison damage of one, like one turn of poison. Well, if you happen to have that Temtem paired up with a Temtem of the toxic type, that attack gets upgraded to a better version of itself that does more damage or makes the opponent be poisoned for more turns. Sometimes it adds an entirely new effect to the attack. And the requirement is just having a companion Temtem that meets the requirements that is needed for the synergy to take place. It creates access to a lot of cool battle strategies that things like Pokemon just don't really have. Another thing is attack priorities. So normally it's about a few things. Like in Pokemon, it would be like the speed of the Pokemon. And then certain attacks might have, like, you can do like a rocket punch or something, so your punch will go first. Or like very few attacks will go last, like Trick Room or whatever. In this game, they have every attack has a priority level. And depending on the priority level, it is a way to break up whose attack goes first in addition to speed ratings. So even if a Pokemon, even if a Temtem, it could be faster. If there's a priority setting in place, sometimes the priority outpaces the other one. And since there's so many more variants of that here, it's more of a concern as opposed to just watching for bullet punch or mock punch or whatever. So I kind of like that too. It makes you learn and understand more of the attack types in the game. One more thing that comes to mind, and I'll kind of try to stop rambling, is there's, well, see, I got, there's at least two things actually. So the next thing is turn requirements, or like buildups. So some attacks, many of the more powerful ones, mind you, you can't just use them the moment a battle starts and spam them. So you can't just be like, I can't even think of one in Pokemon. I'm tired. Fucking Solar Beam or something. you can't just start the battle and go Solar Beam. Instead, the attack might have a actual like charge up meter on its name, which means you have to wait a certain number of turns into the battle before you can even use it. But when that number of turns has come up and expired, now you can use the attack. And when you've used the attack, you have to wait that number of turns before you can use it again. I kind of like that too, because it does a good job of reducing attack spams. And another thing they did that did a good job against avoiding attack spams while also improving some of the freaking like wandering about combat is that rather than give all the moves a certain number of times, you can use it by way of the PP system. You actually have a general stamina bar, and every attack takes a certain amount of stamina to use. If you happen to use an attack that requires more stamina than you actually have it banked up, you'll use all the stamina, and the difference will come out of your hit points. And then you'll go into overexertion mode where you'll lose a turn. So it's like a desperation thing if you just need to get one more move off because you're in a clutch. You can rest between turns to build up your stamina meter again, or you can just be smart about it in a sense and like use your smaller like attacks to so that you don't drain out too fast and allow yourself to attack more frequently or for longer durations of time. Again, that's another thing that I genuinely like about the game. It's just good like that. But then one final thing, I swear, there's other things I could talk about, but it's not even worth it because I'm just basically here to tell you that I think the game is fucking great. It's the fact that evolutions in this game are pretty interesting too. It may not be a big deal for like, you know, like versus modes or like the post meta, which apparently there's a ton of going on there. But in this game, when you battle against Temtem, and let's say you're in a, again, a 2v2 battle, you defeat a Temtem and there's one Temtem left that you're battling with, or you've got to battle a bunch of other Temtems in the background. Like it might be like a trainer battle where there's like six of them you got to deal with and you beat the first one. If your Temtem levels up at that point from the experience, he evolves during the fight and you can immediately start fighting with him in his evolved form for the rest of the battle. That to me is freaking awesome. Like that's happened to me multiple times. Like, oh snap, now I got a whole new powered up dude to fight the rest of this battle. Just what I thought I was about to get my ass handed to me. He leveled up and now he's evolved and now he's stronger. He's got some health back. This is amazing. I like that aspect of the games a lot. Now, the only downsides I can think of that I've come across in this game for the most part are a few things. Nothing really major, but, you know. The first thing is the overall Temtem roster. I do like the Temtems I've come across, and I like the ones I've seen. The downside, though, is that the Temtem count is equivalent to kind of like what the original Pokemon first gen did. It has 164, or somewhere between 164 and 166 different Temtems in this game. And you're exploring a pretty lengthy quest, going to these different biomes, in which the areas you run through are pretty large. You'll see a lot of the same Temtem over and over again in the random encounters. And while I feel like I shouldn't not, I don't think it's a hatred thing. I mean, because the game is still a fledgling product, and they probably are trying to like parse out these things slowly, because I think they're going to add more over expansions and updates. But it still made me sad when I was like, oh crap, I gotta fight this thing again. I'm tired of seeing it. I mean, just ignore it and keep running. Though
it's like random battles in an RPG. You're gonna fight the same shit over and over.
Oh yeah, I'm not gonna say the whole point is the fact that due to like having played these kind of games for years now, the more that they started adding to the games, the more variety you can sometimes see when you're running on a certain region. And yeah. It just makes me sad. Like, I wish I could see more of them at a time per region. But, of course, they do have, like, the scent-type items in this game where if you don't want to deal with random encounters, you can just spray yourself and not have to worry about random encounters for a while. Yeah. Still just something I wanted to point out there. But that was pretty much the main thing I had issue with, really. Like, I've been having... Oh, also, maybe some of the quests might seem kind of like, meh, I don't really care too much. Oh, no, that's what it was. Now I remember. Money's fucking tight in this game. Do don't go to stores thinking you just stock up on potions because better safe than sorry, because you're going to run out of money and be shocked at how slowly you build it back up. It starts to become better later in the game, but early on, money is freaking tight. Watch your shit and watch your purse. And one thing I got to mention about this, there is a battle pass. I kind of cringed when I first saw it, but then I realized it was a bunch of cosmetic crap I don't care about. So I just started ignoring it. So if you
cosmetic
like
and housing stuff like that, I think that's a cool addition to the game that they have, you know, your own house that you can decorate and get furniture. And it kind of adds like an Animal Crossing twist to it.
It's a personalization thing. Like, you can do clothing for yourself.
Yeah.
And personalize the way your character looks. You got the house. But overall,
I just
you can
ran
still
around
buy
in my
there's
underwear.
Like furniture stores, too. Oh, Jesus Christ. Wonder if we freaking like underwear, man. But, like, interesting sound. But with that said, though, it's the same thing. You kind of have a situation where you find yourself thinking, well, I can still go and buy furniture in the game. It's not like I'm limited to what I can get. But if I want to just stick to buying furniture in game and clothes in game, and not worry about bonus feature stuff by way of like a battle pass, I don't have to. But people who like that kind of thing, they ain't going on that. But the most important reason to mention this here is because it needs to be confirmed that there aren't pay-to-win mechanics here. Everyone who's playing this game is playing the game. No one bought a battle pass and now has a super juiced up Tim Tim for multiplayer mode because it doesn't exist. It's not there. So don't think it. And if you do, you're wrong.
The downside is the game has been out for a while on PC. So there are people who do have super powered, like souped up beasties that you'll find early in the game. So you got to be careful who you pick battles with in this game.
Oh, for sure. But even if that's the case, you can at least attribute it to that them having more time to play it. They didn't buy their way to victory. And that's a very important distinction. But, yeah, I mean, like, if you're in it just to play the main game and run through it, I mean, that's fine. You can do that. And here's the thing about that, too, with the whole bit of time. It's kind of like Pokemon. When you get there and you're ready to start breeding your Temtem and getting your good IV, it's like TVs and stuff, but basically it's EVs and IVs. But when you're ready to start building your cool Pokemon team or Temtem team, it's the same logic as if you were playing Pokemon, too. Like, every Pokemon game, you beat the game, then they give you access to the national decks, which allows you to start porting your old Pokemon into the game, which has the same result. People who've been playing Pokemon since, like, Pokemon Crystal and Gold on the Game Boy Color are using Pokemon they made in the Game Boy Color games, in the Switch games, and all of a sudden, now you're like, shit, these things are stronger than me. But no matter how much time was spent playing the old games, it's mostly attributed to knowledge and a stable. You can build a stable of 6 solid Pokemon as long as you have the knowledge to do it. And once you start building up the knowledge and ability to understand how to make good Temtem, you can make a team of them and just get better and make better, different ones rather, as you go. But it's not like these guys have been playing since the beta, therefore, to catch up with them, you got to spend X thousands of hours of playing. You could technically beat the game in 40 hours, get 10 hours of like freaking like gameplay plus YouTube videos and be on par with these guys for multiplayer battles. So like, I only want to point that to make it so that we don't want to dissuade people from thinking they're really behind the eight ball, because they're not. It's just, like you said, due to the whole online element, you will see a guy walk by you with a really cool Temtem, and you're like, how the fuck did you get that? Where'd that come from? And then you'll scan it in your computer and see what it looks like and keep moving, you know? So, but I spent a lot of time on this after I told you earlier the damn game reviews would be short tonight.
Yeah, I was going to point that out, that you said one last thing, like, 6 things ago.
But I feel like Temtem deserved it. Like, it's the kind of game that I feel like people are probably already ready to kind of just call it a Pokemon knockoff and not give it a chance. When the truth is, it does deserve a chance, and it's not a knockoff. It's someone saying, I like Pokemon, but here's what I would do with it, which
they
is
finally
pretty much
made
how
Pokemon
game innovation
MMO.
Happens. It's
what people have been wanting, and they did it. And
exactly.
I think that's worth celebrating. So $45, what are your thoughts?
It's an absolute buy. Worth your dime.
Do you think the price is a bit high on this one, or do you think it's worth the asking price?
I think it's worth the asking price, too, because, again, the game itself is going to cut you like 40 hours, and that already is enough for me. That's like a little over $1 a minute or $1 an hour. So you're going to get that, And then if you're the type that does the multiplayer bit, you got literally hundreds more hours available to you if you start chasing like the freaking Luma versions of the freaking Temtem and getting perfect stacked Temtem and breeding the Temtem just like Pokemon. You could crack hundreds of hours in this game if you wanted to. So that's totally worth the money.
Cool. All right, next game is Four Tails, developed by Alchemy, published by Dear Villagers. Released September 15th on Switch and PC for $19.99. Decide the fate of the world in this ingenious story-driven card game. Four Tails offers a unique take on the adventure genre with a multitude of playstyles and story paths through which you can save the world or bring about its end. Purnell, did you end the world?
I try to, but I like the game too much to end it. So, what you gonna do, Willis? What you gonna do? So this game was one that when you were like, it came down the pike, I didn't really know what the hell to make of it, really. It just seemed kind of odd to me. But it turned out to be a game that attempted to make a twist on a gameplay style we've played in the past. Basically a typical adventure exploration RPG game. So you play as Vulpan, a bird type that I had never heard of until this freaking game. He is a shoebill bird. He and his friend, Leo, are in the midst of going to what's pretty much considered like a final heist of sorts to kind of allow themselves to retire from like the seedy life and get to like living a good retirement. But unfortunately for them, this Leer that they have to steal, that they're charged to steal, ends up imparting a crazy amount of knowledge to Vulpan. Most notably, a number of apocalyptic events that's going to bring about the end of days. Pretty kind of ramp things up really hard on you real fast. So at this point, he just feels kind of compelled to try to, I don't know, avert this shit. So that ends up in taking him across a series of quests and missions to avert this thing. So the gameplay is completely done by way of cards. You have like a table. It's like as he plays on a wooden table, which is kind of nice for visuals. And these cards will be placed on top of the table. These cards are pretty much considered as location cards. It could be like a back alley or a diner or something like that, or a prison, any number of places, really. And your cards that you can play on top of those can be anything from like money, fame, grim, and I'll kind of explain some of what these things are in a minute, but those kind of things, money, fame, grim, or the occasional one-time acquisition items, or actual ability cards that are tied to the different characters that may be in your party. And what ends up happening is you might get yourself a quest that you have to undertake. Like, for example, okay, find your way into the castle. So you might be looking at the location cards, and there's no castle card there. So there's an actual stack of cards that represent locations that you're traversing. And the way to go through the deck to eventually get to the place that you want to be or find place that you might be happy to find is you have to resolve the location cards that are in front of you. Now, each location will have a description and a number of things that can impact. Let's say, for example, a market. Let's go with a marketplace, right? So you might have a card that allows you to steal. And if you use a steal card at the market, you might steal two items of food, which is represented as like apples in this game. And then once you steal the apples, that card location will get discarded and a new location will come out. Or you might instead decide to eavesdrop in that place. And when you do that, you might learn a cool tidbit of information and then get transported to a different location, like a tavern, because the information tells you there's something to learn within the tavern. So now that's a new location you can go to. But this is the kind of stuff you'll do to traverse the different decks of cards. Sometimes you'll play a card that allows you to acquire fame or money or food or grim, or you might have to spend one of those things to get a different thing or an action. Fame is best described as like popularity. People know you, people like you, and you can spend fame to do some pretty cool things, like get people to agree with you and come along with you, and something else I'll talk about shortly. Grim is like the seedier side of things. You do some seedy shit, like steal a lot, or you kill somebody. You'll acquire Grimm, which gives you like negative notoriety. So you can like bully people into doing stuff like, look, I just killed 5 soldiers 3 battles ago. You want to mess with me? No, I don't. Well, get your ass in line. You're coming with me. We're going to unlock this prison and get my boy out. Stuff like that. And it's kind of nice that that kind of thing happens. Though sometimes when you do negative actions, you might trigger like enemies to show up in the encounter card / creature card deck. And what ends up happening is certain locations, when it comes out from the encounter, from the locations deck that I mentioned, it'll have like a sort of eyeball in the corner. And if it does, if you did things that resulted in generating any like enemy cards in that creature deck, they'll get a number of them will get dumped on top of it. And now you cannot engage that location until you resolve the battle that just now been placed on top of the card. If there are other location cards available, you can totally avoid those entirely and just try to just do other things and hope that you never have to deal with it. But eventually in certain missions, you'll have really no choice but to engage that combat, at which point a battle will ensue. And unlike in typical games that involve combat, you don't actually have to always go about killing people. Sometimes you have other options, other things you can do. So let's talk about this, for example. You might come across a group of enemies that you got to fight, and you'll notice on their description that maybe he doesn't need to be killed. Maybe you can just throw some food his way, and he'll be satisfied, and he'll leave the battle. Or you might be able to tell this guy, again, the thing I mentioned before, like, hey, I've killed tons of guys stronger than you by using your fame stat or your grim stat, depending on the type of enemy. And that enemy might go, whoa, too rich for my blood, chief, I'm out of here. And they will leave. And every time these types of guys leave the battle, their morale of the overall group will go down. And each of these enemies has their own amount of points that goes towards their overall morale. If your morale for the enemies gets below 0, any enemies that remain will flee. They will just leave the battle, and you're free and clear. No bloodshed or anything. And to me, that's the more optimal, fun way to deal with battles. I like doing that a lot. However, sometimes you do have to go into a skirmish, and when that happens, you got to just pretty much go into like a skirmish battle, and you will use attacks using like your actual attack stat on your character. And you'll just kind of have this weird clash where your characters will go 1-1-1. I'll just kind of bump into each other until you ultimately end up killing the enemies and resolving the conflict. Again, that to me is the lesser way to end battles, but sometimes you gotta do what you gotta do. In which case, good luck to you out there. Now, when you take enough damage, you might find yourself thinking, well, how the hell do I heal my characters if they take damage in combat? Well, you can use some of the aforementioned food that I described to get food health back. One apple results in 1 HP per character that you use it on. But there's also another thing you can do. So earlier I mentioned cards that you can use that have various character skills on them. When those cards run out or get low, the way you want to get them back is by using the rest action. There's a deck of cards that result in resting. And when you go to that deck of cards, there's a bunch of them that can be there that you can review and see the conditions for. But sometimes you might straight up not like what's available to you, but you're kind of stuck with whatever's at the top of the deck. And when you play that card, it'll have conditions. It'll say something like, either you can either use this item and get three cards back per team member and three health back, or use no items and get 1 health back and 2 cards per character or something like that. So you can use rest cards, and depending on the situation related to them, you can fulfill different conditions to resolve your characters and get them health and their abilities back. But if you go through the entire rest deck before the mission is over, that counts as a game over. So you don't want to exploit rest cards. Be smart about playing your cards and getting things done with them. It's weird to describe this game because it's different, like, which is a rare thing, and I kind of like that. It's a rare thing.
They call it dexploration, which I think is a pretty cool term.
It's a cool term, and it's an accurate term because, again, the deck is the locations, and you resolve the cards to explore more of the deck. So that is literally what it is, and it's freaking fantastic for that right. Like, I've been having good times with this game. And when I first saw, like I said, I saw the original trailer when you offered to me. I was like, what the hell is this? I don't know what I'm even getting into. I wasn't even interested like that. It was like, I'm curious, but I'm not excited, if that makes sense. You know, generally you get excited about things you are familiar with or things that just blow you away with, like, I don't know, popular, like flaring trailers. But this game, once the execution happened, it clicked. And when it clicked, it was fire. This is a very unique silent game. And also, I didn't even mention, there's like, aside from like the characters don't really talk, but there's like a narrator that talks. Well, the characters talk in like word bubbles, I mean. But like the narrator actually has a voice.
Yep, fully voiced narration by Travis Willingham.
I'm not sure who he is, but I need to figure that out because I like the way he sounds in this. I like the way he's got a very like hilarious and like sarcastic way of presenting certain situations. Like, let's say, for example, I use the steel action at like a market to steal apples, right? Which resulted in some guards getting added to the creature deck. The narrator might say something like, "You just couldn't keep your hands clean, could you, Volpan?" And you're like, "Yeah, I couldn't, you know. Just man's got to have his a shoe bill's got to have his apples, you know. I'm hungry." He does a good job. It adds a lot of color and flair to the experience, and frankly, I'm fond of it. It's kind of funny. I don't want to get a bad review game anytime soon, but I almost feel like a shill sometimes because I'm getting a lot of buy it games, and this one is kind of no exception on that rule. It's good stuff.
Well, it's $20. So, what is your official verdict?
I think it's officially a buy it. Get this bad boy today. If cool you like, beans. Yes, get it.
All right, one final game to talk about on this episode is Unmatched Digital Edition, developed and published by Akram Digital, released September 15th on Steam for $19.99. Unmatched Digital Edition is a highly asymmetrical game of card-driven battles between epic heroes from story and myth. Witness clashes you've never seen before in duels or team fights. In battle, there are no equals. Pernell, what's going on in Unmatched Digital Edition?
Unmatched is a game that this game came very a very good time for me because the week before this review code came on, I was actually in an Unmatched tournament, which was my first time playing the game, too. And I was already interested because the premise is pretty freaking solid as it is. But now I get to see the digital game, and I get to see what the hell the digital game is all about. And quite frankly,
how does it does it translate well from physical to digital?
It really does. It genuinely does. I mean, as I've said in the past, like I almost feel like I can never quite get the tactile feel, which is kind of why we have the video versus digital analog in the first place. But if I want to play games with my friends who are not local, digital is the way to go. If I want to practice my skills against myself and an AI opponent, digital is the way to go. In this game, it does the job, baby. It does the job. But I should stop talking about how good this is because the game itself is freaking solid. But let me explain what the game is. For those who are like, what the fuck is this? So,
did you say it was solid or it was salad?
It was, you know what, just for chits and giggles, it was salad.
Okay.
It was balsamic vinaigrette, Cobb salad. And I'm happy with that because I love those things. But what is this game exactly? So the premise of Unmatched is to say taking a number of figures, whether fictional or real, and just like, for example, Bruce Lee or Alice from Alice in Wonderland or Bigfoot or King Arthur, any number of just characters that have been written about. And it's a question of who would win in a fight, Bruce Lee or Bigfoot? Let's find out by playing Unmatched, because each of these characters, if they are in the game, and some of them are in this game, some will likely be coming by way of expansions because they exist in the physical game. But the idea is that each of these characters.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is early access. Right now, there's only 4 playable characters and 2 maps, but there is more that will be coming. They plan on adding. We are planning on adding 2 available characters as well as maps. We are also taking time to develop and test all features proposed by the community during early access. So take that as you will. They plan to be in early access for a few months. The price will not change according to them. So
what are they charging for right now?
$20.
Okay. I just wanted to know
how much is the physical version of this game?
That I honestly don't know because I didn't have to buy it. The tournament that I was in, the guy in preparation for it, he bought the base set that's represented in this game, in this early access game. And he also bought like 6 expansions that combined other additional characters. Like in the menu for this game, for example, 2 of the characters that are coming eventually, you can't select them, but if you were to go to like the tutorial details, like descriptions of stuff, there's like a sort of like a lexicon where it explains the rules of the game and they explain the different character traits. They reference them in that. Those being Bigfoot and Red Riding Hood. And funny enough, Bigfoot was my partner's character and Red Riding Hood was my character in the tournament. And they are both freaking awesome. Bigfoot is overpowered as shit, but that doesn't make him broken. That just means that you have to figure out how to deal with him. That Red Riding Hood was also powerful. You go online, people claim she's the most, one of the most powerful characters. I was frustrated because she's hard to use because of her gimmick. So the idea behind this game is each of the characters that you can play as, in the case of this current state of the game, they have Alice from Alice in Wonderland, Sinbad the Explorer, Medusa, and King Arthur from King Arthur's Court. So you can choose any of those characters, and each of them has a unique ability, a unique deck of cards that they use. Oh, Bryce, you're going to say that a lot in this. A unique deck of cards that contains like attacks and abilities for them, and a partner character that also comes out onto the field with them for combat. When you put them out on the field, you choose like starting locations on the board you're on. And the board is an interesting display. It's a series of nodes, and the nodes have different colors on them. Sometimes they're solid colors, and other times it's more than, it's like multiple colors in one spot. The reason why they are there like that is because there are 2 types of primary attack styles in the game. There's ranged attacks and melee attacks. Melee attacks, you have to be 1 space away from your opponent to use them. However, ranged attacks, it's not a typical thing where it was like, okay, my guy's range is 2 or whatever. Instead, with this game, it's based on the colors of the nodes on the map. If you share the color, if your node shares a color of the node of your opponent, that counts as being within range. And depending on the board you're playing on, those things can be like clustered or they can be scattered about. It gets to be pretty interesting when you're like looking down, like, okay, I think I'm actually within range of that guy because this is some kind of weird like reaching zone. I don't know, but I'm going to use it and use my ranged attack in this range space and frick him up. So those are like the way the styles of the attacks. And on your cards themselves, you have a few different types of things going on there. You have cards that are meant to be used as attack cards. They have a power rating associated with them. You have cards that are meant to be defensive, and they have a defensive rating on them. And you have cards that are meant to do both. You choose which one when you use the card. Also, remember how I mentioned partner characters in the board?
Mm-hmm.
So the cards themselves also can have that kind of distinction. Some cards are meant to be used by the primary character on your team. Sometimes they're meant to be used by the support character. And other times, either character can use them. And when you're playing this game, you have to deal a lot with hand management. Because when you start the game, like I said, you place your characters down and you also get a hand of cards.
You know what else we get?
Subs, isn't it? It's delicious.
We do get a sub from Rootbeer. Thank you so much, Rootbeer. Pernell, do you want to do a live fucking yeah?
Fucking yeah. Thanks, Rootbeer.
Anyway, as you were.
So when you get the cards, you have your cards, you're looking through them, and you have to, I'm going to go through the process of how turns work now. So on your turn, you can take 2 actions, and those actions can consist of, and even be duplicated as, these 3 things. You can maneuver. Maneuver involves moving you and your partner character up to the number of spaces allotted by your character. In the case of this current build of the game, every character, with the exception of Medusa, can move 2 spaces. Medusa can move 3. And also, when you maneuver, you draw a card from your deck. You can use an attack card or ability. Use an attack card. Like if you want to like attack a guy and you have a card that lets you do it, you can use an attack card. And the last thing you can do is use a scheme card. Think of them as like instant action cards that can turn the tide of battle, whether it's like allowing you to get extra movement, scaring a guy back, reloading something, any number of things. I mean, literally, depending on the type of character and how they wrote them, these things can do freaking any damn thing. And it can get crazy if you don't know the character builds in advance. You'll be shocked by some of these things. And you have to do are these two of those two actions consisting of any of those three things to end your turn. And then the opponent gets to do the same thing. Now, an interesting element about this game is like a lot of times in these sorts of deck games, you kind of play through your deck, and when you're done, you shuffle the cards back and you start playing them again. However, in this game, you actually are penalized for running out of cards. You don't replenish your deck. When it runs out, you're borderline fucked because, I hope they don't mind me saying that. But anyway, you're borderline screwed because what happens at that point is you can't get any more cards.
What's making you watch your language now of all time?
I don't know. I just felt surprisingly self-conscious. I get weird sometimes. I blame the canned water. But what ends up happening is every turn you have to do a maneuver and you don't have cards in your hand or in your deck to draw, you and your teammate, or rather you and your support character lose 2 hit points until you die.
Ouch.
So good hand management is important because you run out of cards, you are freaking boned. And certain characters work in different ways. Some characters have you mining the deck for cards. Some will have you discarding cards to do special abilities. So depending on the character you're playing as, you might have to be conservative with your cards. You might be able to say, frick it, I'm aggressive with my cards because at the end of the day, I have tons to burn. It just depends on your characters you're playing as. And the different abilities that the characters have are pretty freaking cool. Sometimes you'll be like, I mean, no matter how like some of them are like, they may be cool, but you're like, ah, frick, this isn't as good as that guy's ability. But at the end of the day, I think I like all of them. And my favorite character's ability so far
has been
Alice from Alice in Wonderland. Because they play into the whole premise of like how she had to drink the potion and become small, or drink the potion and become big. In the premise of this game, she has a freaking giant cleaver. And at the beginning of the battle, you get to choose whether she's big or small, and that's her starting situation. When she's small, her defense goes up by 1 for every time she has to defend against an attack. However, if she's big, all of her attacks get an additional bonus of 2. And trust me when I tell you, in the tournament, I had to battle Alice. She screwed my day up. I hated her. But what I mean by hated her is I was extremely envious of her. Because that ability was really cool.
Sound like you hated this, though.
No, I did not. In fact, I think this game is freaking solid. I'm a big fan of games that do the whole 1v1. What if this character is better than this character? Whether they're characters that are established or characters that were created for the game itself. And when the mechanics are there and they're strong and they're engaging, it's that much cooler. It makes you want to experience the different characters. It's not as ridiculous as just sitting at the table and just rambling back and forth about a bunch of random stats on the internet or things you saw on TV shows. Instead, with this game, it's they created characters to be played. We can settle this ourselves. And you can end the battle. You might lose and go, nah, man, see, that's the problem. My character deck is cracked. And the guy might go, no, you just suck at using them. I don't know what to tell you, Chief. But it's fun. It's engaging. It's not complicated. It's easy to pick up and learn. Again, like the guy, and it's not just me saying it's easy to learn. The guy that did the tournament, he did a pretty easy job teaching. He was teaching it to people, whether they were like not good at the game or not much with the games, or they play like Ticket to Ride exclusively, or if they were playing Ark Nova. It didn't matter. They could pick this game up with a very easy build, and this game has a good tutorial for that, too. So it walks you through all the phases of gameplay, and by way of, like, talking cards, kind of livening up the conversations. It's a solid product, and I look forward to seeing what they do with it as the game gets expanded upon and they add more to it. And I'm trying to get my friend, assuming they eventually make it you can buy it in early access, so I'm trying to convince my friend to eventually get it. I had to wait until he was, kind of dried up from after the tournament and been making his board game pitch and all, but I'm going to get him to buy this freaking game because I want to play it with him online because I can play with him and I have to go out and buy the cards myself and go to his house and do it. So this game to me is a lot of fun physically and it's a lot of fun to me digitally. Again, I feel like I'm a freak.
Hello, you there? Hello?
Uh-oh.
Oh, there you are. There you are.
that scared the crap out of me. I don't know what happened.
You were talking, then you just cut out, And I'm like, hello?
Yeah, I stopped and I was like, yes. So where did I leave off?
I have no clue. It's $20. It's early access. Everyone in chat is suggesting that I create a redeem prompt to end long reviews. So that's what we're doing. It's $20. It's an early access. Is this worth jumping into, or should we wait, wishlist it? What do you think we should do with this one?
I think it's a buy. It also screw the chat.
I want to give a shout out to you, because I thought yesterday was long, where we went an hour with four reviews. We just went an hour on three reviews. So
damn, I'll take it.
Hot diggity. That is it for this episode. We made it through another one. Thanks to you for being here. Thanks to the PartyCast crew for being here earlier in the show. And then thanks to the Neat Microphone crew for coming in and doing the roundtable. It's been so long, I don't remember everyone who's been on this episode. So just thanks if you were here. And if you weren't here, tough shit. How about that? Cornell, do you have any final words to end the show?
Yeah, I said screw the chat, telling me my reviews are too long. Also, have a good night, everybody in the chat.
And everyone listening.
Oh, yeah, and everyone listening. Have a good night, everybody. Good fight, good night.